From the Film Grok Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City, this is Film Grok. My name is Serge Delpierre, and this week we'll be doing the, it's seminal. Sure, they're all seminal. Chinatown from 1974. To my left, I have
Tim McMillan.
And to my right, I have from New York directly
Max Alvarez.
Max, it's great to have you here from New York.
Great to be here, Serge.
Yes, you having a good time here visiting Los Angeles?
Absolutely, especially since I get to see Chinatown again.
Ooh, that's always a good thing. So before we get started, let's get the cueing point ready. What we've done is we've paused it right at the very beginning when the Paramount Pictures logo starts fading in, and that's a black and white Paramount Pictures logo.
A retro logo.
Very retro and working very, very well. So anyway, Max, tell us a little bit about your history with Chinatown.
I first saw Chinatown on July 4th, 1974 in Milwaukee at the old Capitol Court Theater, one of those 1,000-seat cinemas that was built in the 1960s. And I just remember this amazing film being seen on this enormous Panavision screen in an IB Technicolor print, one of the last years that Technicolor was making these kinds of prints. And it was such an impact that it had on me. And I saw it many times afterwards, but never had quite that memorable experience.
I envy you to see it on a big screen like that.
Yeah, really. My first time, actually, since you're talking about first times, it was I saw it in film class. It was actually a class on film noir. Actually, it was called Cinema of Loneliness back at University of Maryland. And one of the films we watched was actually Chinatown. We actually watched The Conversation, too, and we watched some film noir also, like Big Sleep. Definitely this played in there. Mm-hmm. And so I saw it in the class. It was a 60-millimeter print. Not as impressive. And then, of course, later I watched it on video. Tim?
Oh, my goodness. I don't have that much to bring to the table. I've really only seen the film once. Bwomp, bwomp, bwomp. But it's one of those classics that just got away from me for whatever reason. I only caught up with it in the last year to see it for the first time. So I did not see it on the big theater screen. I have not seen it many times over the years. The one time I saw it, I was struck with how layered it was, how dense it was for a screenplay and for the actions going on screen, for the narrative, for the characters, what they're doing, how it all comes together. I was very engrossed, very impressed by how it was handled for the film. And it, as the genre for noir, I thought it was just a beautiful homage to the entire genre.
So here we have three different, not quite generations, but three different experiences. My seeing it theatrically, Sarah seeing it in film school, and then Tim, you seeing it recently, so you could give a more current perspective to the film.
Right, yeah. Right. I knew of its reputation. That was just huge, but I had never seen the work itself. But just in the last year. And it measures up for everything that everyone told me, for being pivotal for that time period, especially in the 70s, for this type of style to come out to be presented in the way it was. And it really lived up. It did not disappoint me. And say, what's all the hoopla about? I did not say that once. I like, this is a major film here that I'm seeing that lives up to its reputation.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back then, I mean, I didn't get to see it because I was too young at the time. I lived in the province of Quebec where the ratings I've spoken about before, I'll speak about again, were basically for all 14 and over and 18 and over. And let me tell you, Chinatown was 14 and over. So I didn't get to see it. I'm like, oh. But I got to see it many years later. But I remember it definitely having an impact. I know my parents saw it and they loved it very much. So,
I mean, I was fortunate to have very hip parents who liked taking me to adult films and interesting films and director-driven films. And the wonderful thing about growing up at this time in the 70s is that you would see a film like Chinatown and knew you were seeing a film for the ages.
Right.
And we don't have that experience very often anymore.
Right. How many Oscar nominations?
11.
Wow. How many did it win?
One.
Four?
Screenplay.
Wait. Jerry Goldsmith didn't win.
Oh. He won 2 years later for The Omen.
That's right. I wish I could have seen this with a live audience, Max, the way you saw it.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been intense.
It was a matinee, and I remember the theater was not that crowded, but on subsequent events, when I saw it in repertory theaters, we did have a lot of people there, and people were pretty blown away by the film, towards the end anyway.
Yeah.
You do hear the
literally.
Laughter. Literally. But you do see the emotions that it takes people through. There's funny stuff in there. There's very suspenseful, and I can talk more about that as we proceed.
I've rarely seen it's such an involving film. I mean, you are a fly on the wall in this movie, following trail after trail after trail, and you get immersed in this world, whether you like it or not. I mean, going along for the ride. And by the end of the film, I was so involved with it and the people. It just really suckered me into this entire environment that it created. I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't think I'd be so quizzical and wanting to know the mystery so desperately as I did and while watching it. It really got me.
It really draws you in. It's very mesmerizing. Yeah. And what amazes me is no matter how many times you see it, you become drawn in all over again. Even though
that's powerful.
What the resolution is going to be, that's real masterful filmmaking.
And that's Polanski.
And that's Polanski.
Who is a master storyteller. I mean, you can watch any of his films. It's just the craft. He just so knows how to tell a story, which is really amazing. That just draws you in. So on that note, are we ready? Here we go. Okay.
We'll proceed with the Wayne Fitzgerald titles.
Wayne Fitzgerald. Thank you. So anyway, I'll count down 3, 2, 1, play, and then we'll all be in sync together. And ready, set, 3, 2, 1, play. Ooh, what's that music?
That would be Jerry Goldsmith's score, but if you heard, that was a strumming of the piano strings. It's not an actual playing of an instrument in its correct or well-known manner. It's just taking the piano strings and strumming it with either a piece of metal or some object. And that's what Jerry Goldsmith excelled at. He took normal instruments and got the most incredible sounds out of them. He didn't care. This is not the way you play a horn. This is not the way you're supposed to play a piano. If it created the sound and the environment he was looking for, he'd use it in that respect. And I love that. Just the strumming of piano strings to start it off.
I really like how the credits just put you in the time period.
But they're very deceptive. They're very deceptive because these credits by Wayne Fitzgerald are supposed to evoke an old-fashioned film right. from the 1940s, even though they didn't often scroll up the screen that way.
Oh, that's right.
So it's this very old-fashioned-looking opening with this stunning, rich score, and then you see where he leads us in the first scene.
Based right. on the background there, that almost like, what, Art Deco? What would you say that is in the back, that design?
Is it
Art Deco or Art Nouveau?
I would say that's a Deco-type design.
Yeah, it reminds me of something Art Deco. With the melancholy horn, it sounds like a bittersweet romance.
It does.
I'm ready for a bittersweet romance to start.
But these strings right here are, I mean, it's gorgeous, but there is a touch of the 70s to it, but a good touch.
It has a tremolo strings in the background, which is Jerry Goldsmith's trademark during the bridge of a song, and that's what sounds 70s, I think, to you at that point.
Which I totally don't mind.
See, I never would have made that connection about that. It's fascinating. And then we go from this very, very old-fashioned retro title sequence to something very contemporary. You would never have seen that in a 1947 film.
Wow, so much for my bittersweet romance.
Actually, pre-code.
Very pre-code.
There we go. That's what it was. They were going for pre-code. Is that Burt Young?
That is Burt Young on the left, who will later appear in the Rocky films.
That's right. This is pre-Rock. Oh,
now, was that a zoom or was that a tracking move? I've just read it.
You know what?
A little bit of both.
But you know what? That's my rule. If it's not obtrusive, then it's fine.
Okay. I just thought I'd point that out as we're talking
that's
about
fine.
Zooms.
I know.
Because Polanski's compositions here are very conservative. He doesn't go for a lot of flashy camera setups in Chinatown.
Now, I have to mention this because, of course, in film school, the whole thing was that the Chinatown screenplay is like the perfect screenplay. And of course, one of the first things that's cited is Jake's dialogue that's coming up. What was it? When you're right, you're right, and you're right?
Yeah, this introductory scene setting the stage for the story.
Mm-hmm.
But the script had a very troubled history and ultimately was a combination of severe compromise between Robert Towne and Roman Polanski, which we can talk about further as the film progresses.
Right. Well, the interesting thing is that, I mean, this has nothing to do with what becomes the core part of the plot, but that's good. Maybe it's good writing because Burt Young's character comes back in and is instrumental for Jake to execute part of the later plot later on.
And also you get a sense of Jake's job. He's basically into matrimonial investigations. He's not a very glamorous private eye who's dealing with murder cases. This is actually a very realistic portrayal of what a private eye really was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So already we're brought right into the main story right here.
That's right. It's like a minute later.
And that would be Diane Ladd, right?
Exactly.
Yep, that is Diane Ladd as Mrs. Mulray. Right.
Exactly. To be continued.
And behind Jack Nicholson is, of course, Bruce Glover.
No, that's not
Bruce. No, right there. Right,
oh,
right there.
Yes, there's exactly. Glover. There's Bruce.
Bruce Glover, a great character actor from the late 60s and early 70s, worked later, and of course, father of Crispin Glover.
I had no idea.
And he played
one. Oh, really?
I had no idea about that.
3 years before this, he played one of the gay villains in Diamonds Are Forever.
Diamonds Are Forever, which was cut.
Mr. Quint and Mr. something or
which
other.
Which was cut out of the TV version, which is the version I always saw.
So I never knew.
And Crispin. Then only later when I watched on TV, I'm like, oh.
Now, here's an example of the wonderful composition by Polanski. This is a Panavision film in anamorphic widescreen. The way it's two very simple shots, but beautifully arranged. With
and
the
we
actors.
Have a person sitting in the back of the foreground person in each shot, balancing it out. If you look and see, there's someone behind him off filling the frame that way, behind Nicholson, and someone behind Diane Ladd.
Well, in the same negative space.
Same negative space.
But they're basically looking across the line, which is very great composition.
Having that noir feel, we have the slats of light right there on Nicholson. Behind him on the wall in the back. That's
got to have the Venetian blinds.
Yes, the Venetian blinds, which...
And the cigarettes.
I mean, the concept of a color noir was very new, or a color neo-noir, because we associate these films with being black and white.
Right.
That's true.
Monochromatic.
But if you look at the tones, I mean, it's all earth tones right now.
Very much so.
Hang on, let's go to the other... Come on, switch to the other shot.
There's a lot of black in Diane Ladd's.
Oh, right, that's right. But she's wearing black, but of course she's the evil one.
Not a lot of color here. And Polanski claimed in his autobiography that Paramount had wanted him to shoot this in black and white. It's funny thinking of a studio doing that.
Well, I think, as you mentioned before, Paper Moon was the same year. Previous year, okay.
And a big hit.
Well, Bogdanovich had done Paper Moon and Last Picture Show and had great success with that.
But Polanski wanted a very modern look in Technicolor and Panavision. And here we are immediately brought into the political content of the story.
Right.
Wonderful line.
Which line particularly?
Los Angeles is a desert community. This is all about the irrigation systems that are being planned for Los Angeles. And Robert Towne claims that his inspiration for the story was a book that was written in the 1946 called Southern California Country, an Island on the Land, which had a chapter called Water, Water Everywhere, which dealt with the whole utilities battles in Los Angeles County, although at a much earlier era than in which Chinatown takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Robert Towne, I have some information. In 1971, producer Robert Evans originally offered Towne $175,000 to write a screenplay for The Great Gatsby, but Towne felt he couldn't better the F. Scott Fitzgerald novel. Instead, Towne asked for $25,000 from Evans to write his own story, Chinatown, to which Evans agreed. So originally he was hired to do The Great Gatsby, but turned it down.
Oh, and Coppola wound up writing that. So.
Exactly.
Now this is Mulray, right?
This is Hollis Mulray, Evelyn Mulray's husband, who works with the Department of Water and Power, whom she suspects of having an affair. And initially our reaction is kind of amusing because he's such a conservative, buttoned-up type. It's difficult to imagine him being in a scandal.
Right.
And then we hear of the...
the sheep.
The various farmers here protesting this regulation.
Now, apparently, Mulray was based on real-life William Mulholland.
Yep.
Who oversaw the water in Los Angeles in the up to the 30s, apparently. That's what I'm reading here. The characters Hollis Mulray and Noah Cross are both references to the chief engineer of Los Angeles, Department of Water and Power, William Mulholland.
Right.
Mulray is partially an anagram for Mulholland.
Mm-hmm.
The name Noah is a reference to a flood to suggest conflict between good and evil in Mulholland. Noah, the great flood. So, I never knew that.
And we've just seen a perfect example of Polanski's compositions. It's all been in one shot with the car arriving at the reservoir and then panning to J.J. Gittes and his binoculars.
Right.
And then here a POV shot.
I mean, I remember watching this and going like, what the hell is going on at this point? There's water. There's desert.
And here you really get a sense of what a visual director Polanski is.
Right. And that exactly gets told all visually. Because, I mean, you don't expect movies, detective movies, to be about water in the desert.
And it's very subjective. Yeah. Isn't Nicholson pretty much in every shot in this film? So we live through him in this movie.
Hmm.
So everything he's seeing, we're trying to figure out along with him. So we become him, basically.
Which is very noirish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very expressionistic, actually, which noir has its roots in, is expressionism. Part of its roots.
And often there's the narration from the main character, which you don't have in this film, which you don't really need.
Right. Refreshingly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Polanski, because Polanski is master storyteller.
Exactly. So there was a lot of disagreements with him in town on the structure of the film, because town was very much into research and there was a lot of statistical information about the whole utilities issues in Los Angeles, and Polanski wanted simplified.
So he just stripped it down to its essence from what the over research that town was bringing to it?
Apparently so, after much debate and argument between the two of them. Mm-hmm.
But understandably so. I mean, you can't have it all be all about research, but you know,
exactly.
Polanski was looking at it, what elements can I take of this great research to tell my story? You know, and it's interesting. Basically, he's got, you know, get us following Mulray around to the different points that we're going to come back to in this film. Everything's going to play again.
It's almost a little touch of Vertigo, it seems, where he's following around.
We need Bernard Herrmann to chime in on.
Precisely.
I can take Jerry Goldsmith.
Now, what he does here, now we're switching to a handheld, and he does this a couple of times during the film. And the cinematographer, John Alonzo, he's interviewed in a very interesting documentary called Visions of Light that was made in the early 90s. And he talks about some of the challenges he had trying to accommodate Polanski by going from very stationary camera shots to handheld, but how he ultimately agreed with Polanski's decision to those abrupt changes.
Right.
My favorite thing, let the camera tell the story. I just love this. When's the last time we heard dialogue? I mean, we've gone quite a long time.
Well, that's stunning. That's filmmaking, you know, show, don't tell.
Real filmmaking.
Now, what had Polanski done? I'm like, he's still sitting there.
Great
what film. Had Polanski done before this?
Before this? Are you sure you want to know the answer to that question?
I do want to know the answer.
It's nasty. Two films before this was the brilliant Macbeth. In 1971. Ooh. And then right before Chinatown, he made a disastrous Italian comedy called What? With Marcello Mastroianni, which was just kind of a Shaggy Dog story that he did as a lark. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the few films by a master that you can say is a real turkey.
Oh.
But Chinatown put him back on the track.
Well, Rosemary's Baby was 68.
Right, so that would have been his other American film that was made 6 years earlier.
Was it? I thought Rosemary's Baby was earlier.
Rosemary's Baby was 68.
Oh, it was 68.
And then came Macbeth, and then came What, and then came Chinatown.
Okay.
I have never seen Rosemary's Baby.
Ooh. Got to see that. That's a film.
That is a great film.
That is a great film. Oh.
We're hearing Bunny Berrigan singing I Can't Get Started. It's another example of terrific uses of source music coming from presumably a jukebox.
I love what he does here. I was like, what the hell is he doing here? But it's great because, I mean, even in, what, 73, 74, this was still, in a way, a period film. And now you can imagine, now it's really a period film. But still, what he's doing, I'm like, Yes?
Talking about I Can't Get Started,
mm-hmm.
Bob Evans, I'm reading from the liner notes of the Chinatown soundtrack release, says Bob Evans had fallen in love with I Can't Get Started by Bunny Berrigan, and he thought that the whole picture should have that flavor. Goldsmith told him that he didn't think that that kind of music would be right for the picture and that the visuals already established the setting as 1933 Los Angeles. Goldsmith grew up in Los Angeles, and amazingly enough, he says that's the way it looked. He said it would have been too much of a reemphasis of the 30s with that kind of music. So Goldsmith told the producer and director that what he was dealing with in the film are characters and that the time was of little significance. It could be 1933 or the present. Bob Evans understood. He said, you're right. So the score for Chinatown does contain several pieces of source music used to heighten the sense of realism, but these selections do not function in the foreground of the drama. So that's when Goldsmith took it and just orchestrated it as a modern film.
And it's interesting. So they refer to it as 1933.
Yeah.
Because actually it's 1937. The story actually, there are only two signs that it takes place in 1937 in a scene that's coming up in a movie marquee, and then later in a license plate of a car. And this scene here is the first dialogue we're hearing since that long, wonderful
stretch.
And we're introduced basically to
John Huston,
the villain of the piece.
Does we haven't met
Noah,
him yet.
Noah Cross, correct?
Yes,
Noah
Cross. Always Noah Cross. Oh, yes. Oh, is he Noah Cross? John Huston, who really hadn't acted all that much.
Usually just in his own films occasionally, playing Noah in the Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
Another Noah.
Smaller parts.
Right.
But exactly, and it's only in the early 70s that he started actually acting more. I know he did this, and he did Battle for the Planet of the Apes. He played the lawgiver. And I think he did one or two other things.
I found it interesting that in his introduction in the photographs, he was covered in the chemicals in order to keep it, but it looked like water.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So water is over him on each shot.
Oh yeah.
I've never made that connection before. That's marvelous. And they're about to go to Echo Park. Water again.
Yeah.
And here we are on location. Bruce Glover rowing him. So the setting is officially 1937, which also happens to be the year Jack Nicholson was born.
Ooh.
And since this does ultimately involve questions of parents and who were the real parents, there's a zoom for you, Serge.
Mm. Yeah, I caught that one. I was watching the people rowing at Echo Park.
But it's ironic that because people questioning who their parents are in this film, Nick Nicholson himself had questions about his own parents having been adopted.
Oh, really? Okay.
This was pretty much Jack Nicholson's... Did this push him into superstardom?
Yes.
Yeah, this was it, yeah.
I mean, he already made Easy Rider, him recognizable. Then came Five Easy Pieces, which was a success, and Carnal Knowledge was very respected. But Chinatown was considered the one that really put him out there in the orbit.
And then, of course, you know, he got paired up with Faye Dunaway, who had been around. It was definitely a star by then.
Yeah, but she was hard up for work, and they were actually able to get her very...
Ooh, look at that optical effect.
That's an optical effect.
Yeah. Mm.
Hard up for work, so this was a dry time for her?
It was a dry time for her. They got her very cheap, because I think Nicholson got $500,000, and she got 10% of that.
Oh, wow.
And the film itself only cost $3.5 million in 1970s dollars. The theater in the background, by the way, is showing two Paramount films from 1937, Double or Nothing and Exclusive with Fred McMurray.
Yes.
This was the Paramount backlot, which I believe Michael Eisner had torched by an arsonist in the early 80s.
What?
According to a film historian.
No.
Go ahead. Go after me, Michael. I don't care.
Oh, boy.
And I believe that's C.O. Doc Erickson, who was he worked on the film in a very important production capacity.
Oh, the one who's speaking right now?
Yes.
Sitting in the other chair?
I believe so, yes.
So how many cameos on that level are there? Because Polanski makes a cameo.
Yeah, I don't think there are that many.
Not many? Okay.
I don't think there are too many. And here we get into the political aspect where he's squaring off with a banker during the Depression.
Right.
Who's accusing him of exploiting people.
That's true. This was your Depression era. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the height of the Depression. And then
I like how the barber's trying to talk him down.
We get into the joke here, and there's an interesting voice sound transition. And then the sound goes out.
And knows, of course, the reference to something Chinese. That's right, where it's starting to leak in the stories about Chinatown.
Exactly. Notice how the detail is so wonderful. There's an Underwood typewriter in the background.
Now, of course,
the famous joke that he tells as a way to introduce the character of the real Evelyn Mulray.
Oh, that's right.
And so when in the background you see more of that very 1940s lighting.
Yeah.
Someone once suggested that this is a great scene, but it would have even been stronger if Faye Dunaway had provided the punchline to the joke. I kind of like that idea, actually.
If it had been done well.
If it had been done well.
It could have played, yeah.
But I think it works just as well because she lets him basically make an ass of himself. And
it would have showed what a tough cookie she is just to say the punchline.
But that's the thing is she's not a tough cookie.
Well, she
she's tough
projects,
anyway, yes.
But what's truly inside is...
Right, exactly.
Now, this was important, the way she appears. Maybe those of you who can sense the detail of the makeup and hair, I mean, she really is made to look of the period. She's very much made to look of the period.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is one of the problems in period films in Hollywood, is you can always tell when they're made by the women's hair and makeup. Yet, for the most part... It really does have a period look to her.
She got rid of her eyebrows, and they're penciled in.
Yeah.
And the hair.
Oh, and she's gorgeous in this, absolutely.
She really is.
She photographs just, I mean, that shot. There's a shot in this where she's just luminous. It's inside
there
of
are several.
Cafe, and just, oh, man.
I know exactly what shot you're thinking of.
But going back to the previous thing, when he was telling the whole joke, I love how Polanski just held on that and held on that and had the confidence to hold it because he knew Nicholson could carry the performance and the dynamic played itself out completely, and he didn't shy away from it.
And in holding it, I got more uncomfortable, which is exactly what you
desired effect. Polanski's expert at doing that. I mean, if you watch Rosemary's Baby, there's some moments in there where he just exactly does that. And I'm like, oh, you are so good.
He doesn't pull it back for the sake of the audience. He's going to just say, let's go to here.
Okay, there's one shot in Rosemary's Baby. Basically, what he does is when he basically photographs someone, then they're halfway in a doorway, and basically he makes everyone lean around the corner and watch.
Yes.
Which is
and here we see the secretary quickly through the back of the door.
Yeah, exactly.
That's Ruth Gordon you're talking about.
Oh,
I know that shot, exactly.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And also credit also should be given to the editor Sam Osteen, who co-edited Rosemary's Baby and fully edited Chinatown, and also worked on Carnal Knowledge and some films for Mike Nichols.
That's right. He was a
terrific
editor. Mike Nichols' editor, absolutely, yeah.
And his work here is almost invisible. I mean, you don't really... Oh, you're not aware of the editing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Max, you had mentioned to me, casting-wise, Faye Dunaway was in Robert Evans, not the first choice.
She was not the first choice, and
who was the first choice?
The first choice was Ally McGraw, wife of Robert Evans. Makes sense because she was in Love Story, and she had been in The Getaway 2 years before
this. She was hot.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately for film history, Steve McQueen got involved with her and created a great friction in her marriage to Robert Evans, which resulted in her not getting the part for Chinatown.
And then we got Faye Dunaway, which we're very happy for.
In hindsight, I'd say I'm so glad that Steve McQueen stepped in.
I've been very grateful to him as well.
In that respect only.
Was Faye Dunaway nominated
for
an Oscar?
Not to break up a marriage. But
Faye Dunaway nominated for an Oscar? I want to say yes.
I don't know for sure.
There were 11 nominations. So.
Yeah. It certainly is very familiar. Ellen Burstyn won that year for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Right. Oh, excellent. Once again.
Faye Dunaway nominated for Best Actress.
Okay.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Okay. Once again, the detail is just...
Oh, it's extraordinary.
It's great.
It's extraordinary. And
great production design.
Richard Silbert, another master who worked, I believe also he had a part in Rosemary's Baby, and tremendous work, part of the Silbert production design dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
Venetian blinds, baby.
Venetian blinds.
Oh, the Venetian blinds are going to be all over the place. It's classic.
But once again, the color brings it into the present.
Earth tones.
But once again, it's all been earth tones. Yeah, everything's wood. Everything's brown.
And this score by Goldsmith, you know, there's only really 23 minutes of score.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Everything else is source music. Oh, now, that can be contributed to one of two things, or both. People say, oh, Goldsmith, and which is true, he knew when not to spot. I mean, when to leave music out, which is just as important. But when you only have 10 days, you can only do so much. This was a replacement score. He was expected to spot, compose, orchestrate, and record this entire score in 10 days. This was done that in 10 days.
This is the problem with Hollywood, because they don't give the composers enough time to work on the pictures, which is not the case in Europe and other countries, where oftentimes the scores are written before the film is made.
Yes. The good old days. But being a replacement score, this was a desperate, dire situation.
Yeah.
Can I just point out there's a swordfish on the wall?
What does that mean to you, Serge?
It means it's talking about water.
Because
in other words, you could have had anything on the wall. There's swordfish. There's a picture of a fish. It's all about the water. It's all pointing back to
brilliant.
It's all about the water.
And the actor on the left is John Hillerman,
yes,
who had appeared in a number of Peter Bogdanovich films. Mm-hmm. He had two roles in Paper Moon the previous year. Terrific character actor.
He had two roles in that?
Yes. He played both brothers, both brothers.
Oh, man. That's right. I've got to see that film again. It's been such a while. He was
at
also
Long Last Love. He was at Long Last
yes,
Love.
Yes, he was in that too, and he was very good in
see,
it.
See, I remember him from Magnum P.I.
Yes, that's
most. Well, I mean, but he's been in other things, obviously. He's of course, like everyone else, he's great. Oh, is that?
And this is Claude Mulvihill, that sleazebag, who's going to be a problem later on. And here we're back to the handheld photography.
He's still a problem. And that's great because it goes handheld. You know automatically there's something up. It's just not as safe as it was before.
Exactly. There's something anxiety-provoking about it. Absolutely.
Which once again, is just that subtle way Polanski picks it.
You're right. When you think about it, that's when he takes on the handheld photography.
Mm-hmm.
And take note, Jack Nicholson is in every shot. We're seeing it through
his
eyes.
There's not a scene that he's not in. You're right.
It's very subjective.
Remember Lady in the Lake, of course, with, was it Alan Ladd?
That one was with...
Which was a little different.
Dick Powell. Correction. Robert Montgomery.
Robert Montgomery? Okay, who played...
Philip Marlowe.
Philip Marlowe in that, yeah. Of course, Alan Ladd had played Philip Marlowe in another film. I'm embarrassing myself, but... But once again, that the whole point of they took it to the extreme where it was all from his point of view, and you only saw him in the mirror. But that's the whole point, once again, of expressionism or of the idea being behind film noir is it's all from one person's point of view.
Precisely.
And here, basically, Polanski does it without having the narration.
And there really weren't that many film noirs that had private investigators or detectives as their central figures. A lot of people may not be aware of that. We always associate the quintessential film noir with being about a private eye. And there really aren't that many aside from those Philip Marlowe stories you mentioned and a few others.
Whether it was mostly cops?
A lot of times it was just people who are drawn into very dangerous situations, who are just normal people. Sometimes it's centered around gangsters or around policemen trying to crack a case.
So basically the whole Philip Marlowe, Sam Spade thing is an aberration for
film. Exactly.
We associate, so why do you think... that's weird.
Isn't that insane?
I never... James Hong. Yes.
James Hong.
Of course, who, of course, appeared in Blade Runner 8 years later.
Precisely. Very good. No, that's important.
No, I like how he just closes the door on him. It's like, buddy, you're not privileged.
Giddis, I think, is very useful.
This is a great use of sound. You first hear the squeaking of the car being waxed or polished, but then
how it's framed with the palm on the left.
Mm-hmm.
That butler's got a lot of attitude.
I actually met him once. He's a great guy. Yeah. Once again, earth tones. Everything's
now,
earth tones in this.
Very, very earth tones.
I don't think I've seen any red.
Apparently, it was even... Paramount even wanted it more earth-tonier. They wanted it to look even more like the original Godfather and were ordering the dailies to be printed very darkly, and Polanski had to intercept.
Okay.
I was just glad in that last shot the light through the windows wasn't burned. It was balanced very nicely.
Yes.
A lot of 70s stuff, it's way too burned.
Blown out windows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. He avoids that. And there's some other great examples of that as well.
And once again, I mean, notice this. We're handheld, but we're over Nicholson's shoulder, so... It's subjective and it's objective. So he's part of what we're seeing, and we're like seeing it with him because he's leading us up to what is going to essentially be a very important clue to everything later on. Not right now, but it's all set up. He's investigating and he's trying to find out, and he's just seeing a bunch of very interesting people.
And look how long it's being held.
Exactly. Isn't that amazing?
And that's the point. It's like
the breathing of this.
But notice also he's basically made that character who's doing all that in the pond interesting in and of himself. He's not a boring character. Physically, he's interesting.
Not just background.
And eccentric. And look how he walks.
It's from an era where they trusted the audience to actually absorb a scene and almost edit the scene.
Well, but I think it has to do with Polanski, too.
And Polanski as well.
Polanski has the confidence to say, this is how I tell my story.
But how many so many directors lack such confidence today?
Well, I mean, he had the confidence and he's... You know, was able to pull it off too.
I had mentioned that, and that of course was going to play a part later.
What's that?
I had mentioned that there was a university press book in the late 70s, I believe, around 1978, about Asian images in American film, written by a Chinese American academic who was critical of the way the Chinese characters appeared in the film with their pidgin English. He thought that Chinese of the 1930s already had been several generations, or at least a generation, raised in the United States and would have spoken better English. This scene, from what I understand, was the first scene they shot for Chinatown, opening day.
Wow.
Things were very tense. Relations between Polanski and Faye Dunaway were very bad, and I think Richard Silbert said that Polanski deliberately positioned Faye Dunaway facing the sun because he was really angry at her. Now, it makes her look very beautiful.
However, it gives her a great,
it's a stunning shot of her, but it was not out of endearment.
I love that. Who's got the power? Who's got the power?
Exactly.
Oh, look at that. You could tell her brow is really sweaty.
Now, she claims she has just been riding bareback. At a contemporary review from 1974 that I read, and this may have been in an alternative publication, said that they got the impression that she was coming from a sexual experience, which I thought is interesting. Now, whether Polanski intended that or not, it's a way of interpreting the scene.
Yeah, I didn't get that part.
Okay.
I would say, yeah, she's been out.
She's been riding a horse.
She's hot and sweaty.
I didn't say this was my
theory. It's Southern California, and you know what? It gets hot in Southern California.
Hard and put away wet. You can take that in any interpretation you'd like.
Holy crap. Once again, I love his ties. Look at his ties.
Great ties. Great and costume also, work.
And actually, three-piece suits, which, of course, came back in the 80s, and then...
Although not as nicely.
Promptly went away.
Yeah, just to look at an era where that was the norm... You didn't leave the house, or you didn't go into town, or without putting on a suit like that.
I know.
Women had gloves and hats.
Which by the 70s, that had changed. That was starting to. That basically started changing.
So. There was a big interest in, and I suppose the Godfather films were a lot to do with this of stories set in the 30s and the 40s, and almost in a, I guess you could call it nostalgia. But a very dark side of nostalgia in this case.
Right.
I had some information that Town had originally planned a trilogy about the character J.J. Gittes. The second one was The Two Jakes, which was directed by Jack Nicholson, right? Which I haven't seen. Max, yes. You saw
correct,
that.
Correct, 1990.
And I've seen it too. Yes, we both made a look.
Yeah, it Two Jakes has a terrific production design, some really good performances, but Jack Nicholson is not Roman Polanski as a director.
No. Jack Nicholson is a great actor.
We are at an actual Department of Water and Power reservoir.
Yes.
And some people may wonder, how did they get access to the DPW facilities, considering how badly the Department of Water and Power comes off in this film?
Yeah.
Well, they just told the DPW they were shooting a film set in the 1930s. Can we use their reservoir? And they said, sure, come on in.
Ouch.
Exactly.
Didn't bother saying, guys... We're tearing you a new one, but okay. How did they feel about it afterwards? Did they not care?
I didn't hear the results of that, but I don't think many of films have been shot at the DPW facility since then.
Well, that's okay.
I'm sure the department did their research the next time they were approached by a film company asking for their resources.
Now, once again, we're going to switch camera styles here. This is a tripod shot, and now we're going to be switching... As Escobar is introduced, this is an extensive handheld
shot. It's like right there it started.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, because, of course, Escobar represents instability in Jake's life.
Well,
I mean, basically, he's the one guy who can take him down.
I don't like where the sun is because the shadows on their eyes.
But I think that's intentional.
Overhead, I'd rather see their... faces a little better.
The middle actor, and I wish I knew his name,
Charles Dierkopf.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
He also appeared in some film noirs in the 1950s.
Well, he was a big character actor in the... He was in The Sting.
He was in The Sting. He
played the guy who's like trying to look over Paul Newman. Paul Newman's shoulder. Great character actor.
Yeah. Once again, great composition here. I mean, there they are filling out the screen beautifully, and it's handheld.
And I think Tim, the shadow in their eyes is intentional.
Just because they're not revealing all of who they are?
Yeah, I think they could have easily, they could have had basically a bounce card in front of them and filled it in, and I'm not seeing any bounce.
Although I don't know how much control they could have over that.
Well, I mean, I'd say how exacting. I know, I can imagine Polanski and Alonzo are. I'd say they were like, yeah, it works.
That's, midday, noon. I mean, you have overhead light. So just a matter of maybe that's just the only time they could get the shot.
And this is the really chilling part. I remember, at least as a kid, it's like, oh, my God, when they find the body of Hollis Mulray.
Oh, man. How old were you?
14.
Wow.
Those were popping eyes. That's a little scary.
Exactly.
So is that on the table.
That weren't pretty.
There's some very subversive composition in this scene, as you'll see.
Right now?
Coming up.
Ooh.
As they enter the morgue.
And look at her. She is amazing.
Yeah, he got a performance out of her. Just remarkable. And there's that burnt look, as you're talking about.
So this was the same year as Towering Inferno?
Yes. Well, we were commenting.
For Faye Dunaway?
For Faye Dunaway, yes.
So 6 months later came The Towering Inferno. So it was a big year for her.
Yeah, and then after that she did 3 Days of the Condor.
That's right.
Yes, one of my favorite films.
So,
and on her way to Network.
And on her way to Network.
Where she won. Yeah,
that was the
streak.
So that was pinnacle.
The pinnacle, and then there was not much for her. Places for her to go after that. Of course, women's roles in the 70s were terrible. They're not great today either, but to have a role for a woman this strong in 1974 was unusual.
Right. I mean, she carved out herself a really good career in the early to mid to late 70s, and then, of course, films started basically
tapering
completely
off.
Well, all films started tapering off then, except for Star Wars.
we will argue about that one another time. The cultural Chernobyl of American cinema.
But films change. Ooh. I mean, but that's the whole thing. Films did change. I mean, that's part of it. And what role?
Also, studio power structures changed. And
that's important. Well, exactly. I mean, that's why films changed also, because of tastes and also because of where the
directions
are
coming
from.
Well, Tim, could you point out about, you were talking about this median period where you could still get a film made with some personal, where the director still had some.
Right. Again, reading
signature.
From the liner notes in the soundtrack album by Kevin Mulhall, it says, Roman Polanski's Chinatown is a classic film from a classic era in American film history in the early to middle 1970s. During this period, the traditional conflict between art and commerce was relaxed as a new wave of individualistic filmmakers took the country by storm. Whether they worked independently or within the studio system, directors like Coppola, Altman, Scorsese, Lucas, and Spielberg consciously or unconsciously created a neo-golden age movement in the art form. Adding to this sense of excitement was the support given to these films by the critics and the general public. So the relaxed atmosphere between art and commerce at this time allowed it to where the suits would not interfere.
Well, it's that the suits, you know, there wasn't much consciousness to basically muffle criticism in the early phases. So you could have, I mean, as
this is the Paramount backlot again.
Very nice. I mean, part of the, you know, I guess counterculture, because it is part of the counterculture, so to speak, if we had all this.
So this window in the 70s, it wasn't by corporate committee, how to destroy a vision of the filmmaker.
Right.
Precisely.
By the time the film finally came out.
And market research was not as strong back then either.
Now, of course, this is the year that Godfather Part II came out.
Yep.
And I'm just thinking back to this. I mean, as great a film as this is, I just have a memory of this. It's just that Godfather II almost basically sucked all the air out of the room, to the point where, I mean, this was a great film, but Godfather II, what the hell was that on the right?
Well,
I saw pubic hair.
That was this was the subversive shot I meant to.
Holy
I was talking
crap.
About.
Was that
earlier.
Just me? Or
no. There was full frontal nudity of a corpse. Yeah, that was Polanski was being very mischievous.
Yes, yes.
I did see pubic hair.
And we caught it in the '70s. I remember when I saw it again with my parents. My mother said, "Did you see that? Isn't that brilliant?" She said.
Wow, you got a cool mom. Anyway, what I was saying is that, you know, basically that. I mean, the Godfather overshadowed. I mean, here you had two great films in the same year, but Godfather Part II was even greater in a way.
Look, the Academy can be forgiven for giving the Oscar to The Godfather Part II. It's truly a great film as well.
Not necessarily
Oscar wise, but just in terms of culture wise, quality, and in terms of how something would be remembered in history.
I think there's truth to that.
So.
It was a real high quality of filmmaking.
Did you run down the Best Picture nominees for that year?
The Best Picture nominees of 1974, you have Chinatown. You have two films by Francis Coppola, The Godfather Part II and The Conversation.
Very good film.
You have Bob Fosse's Lenny, marvelous picture.
Yep.
And then filling out the nominees for reasons which still escape all of us, The Towering Inferno.
Oh, come on.
Yeah,
it makes complete sense to me. That film was awesome. It had Steve McQueen. It had Paul Newman.
All-star cast going
William
head-to-head.
William Holden, Faye Dunaway. Fred Astaire got nominated for
Best
Supporting
Actor.
I mean, you can't beat that. And you had a building that was burning.
On fire, man.
Based on two books, not just one, The Glass Inferno and The Tower. I know this because I read those
It sounds
books.
Like great art to me, absolutely. You're right. It absolutely deserved to be
see,
in the presence
this
of
is
those.
What this is what happens when I can't get in to see Chinatown. I go to films like The Towering Inferno.
I was robbed of hearing Irwin Allen's acceptance speech for being best producer, for best picture of the year. I wish I could have seen
that. I don't think it broke his heart. I think he was just laughing all the way to the box office. You're like, hey, I'm going to make The Swarm next. Okay.
And then here...
Now, notice, remember before we saw... Before he was looking down, and now we actually have him in action. He was observing, he's now... Now this is the clue that he is now going to become sucked into the story.
And Jerry Goldsmith's music.
Which is what happens after this. He does get sucked in.
Because it's so scarcely filled with score, the times you hear score, it makes such an impact.
Yeah, and in that way...
And that's what we lose in today's films. It's wall-to-wall score.
Bombastic.
But that's the blessing in a way of him having to... Now, why did he have to redo the score? Let me ask you.
The name of the man, Philip something. You have to forgive me, I don't know the last name.
He replaced someone.
He replaced. I have a... interesting tidbit on that about the replacement on that. First off, the trumpet line in the main melody, Ewan Racy, I'm trying to pronounce that correctly, a celebrated Hollywood studio trumpeter, heard on the soundtrack, later told an interviewer that Arthur Morton, Goldsmith's The Ranger, who did Chinatown, said, quote, play it sexy, but like it's not good sex.
That's amazing directions. I love that.
I like how the kid's riding that. Is that a burro?
He's on a burro.
I'm like, whoa, that's a kid.
I can tell you about the replacement score. Philip Lambro wrote the original score. It was screened in San Luis Obispo a few weeks before it was released. Mm-hmm. The audience walked out for the most part, scratching their heads, not liking it. Robert Evans said he contacted Goldsmith and he had 10 days to do the replacement score from start to finish.
And he did it.
Well, now, Polanski in his autobiography was very angry that Evans was taking credit for the Goldsmith music, but he didn't really elaborate. So there was a little bit of a falling out between the two of them over Evans trying to assume credit for a lot of that.
Well, it says Mr. Towne was present at the first recording session for Goldsmith's score and said you could see the movie come to life. It was like you couldn't see the movie with the other score, and now you could. And then that's when Towne said, oh, my God, I think we may have a chance.
It's amazing what a music score can do for a film or not do for a film.
We're leading up to the scene, right?
We're leading up to...
Oh, this is coming up to what?
The big shocking scene.
That's right.
And Nicholson did his own stunts here. And when you see this master shot that's coming up... When the water comes.
I like it that the water's lit.
Yes.
Well, I like
in that trench. Yeah.
Of course. See, now, this is actually Nicholson here.
Yeah.
This is not a stuntman.
It does take you by surprise.
Yeah.
All that water coming out.
So they actually put it... Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty impressive shot right here when you consider...
And it's handheld.
And it's all handheld. These are things audiences take this stuff for granted, but there's so much that goes into it.
Right. But, I mean, once again, the handheld just says, this is what's coming.
He lost his shoe?
He's lost his shoe,
that's
yes.
That's right.
Goddamn Florsheim shoe.
Yeah. And, of course...
And then we have the famous cameo... Probably the most famous director cameo in history.
this is perfect because, like, well, if someone's going to do this,
might as well be Roman Polanski, and there he is.
Oh, wow. Hey, kitty cat.
My question is, how were Polanski and Nicholson getting along at this stage? Put Dunaway in the sun. Why is he cutting Nicholson's nose?
because they are having fun.
They're actually very good friends. They had some arguments during production because Nicholson wanted to watch a sporting match on television at one point.
Oh, man. And it's like the rudest.
Yeah, I remember that scene.
That is like the rudest. I mean,
jumping out of my seat when it happened.
But now let's take this.
There's a lot to say about this.
No, let's go meta for a second. Okay, so here's the director. He comes up to the actor and says, you cross me. This is what happens.
That's what I'm saying. How are they getting along off screen?
Well, they're getting along pretty well off screen.
No, but that's my point. It has nothing to do with him taking it on Nichols. He's saying, okay, this is our story, but I'm saying to anyone else, you fuck with me. This is what happens. I deal with you like this.
There's so much to talk about here. Okay, Pauline Kael, whom I don't admire, but who, mm-hmm. and who always had it in for Polanski, said that the scene that we just saw was supposed to remind people of the killing of Sharon Tate, Polanski's wife.
What? Oh, my
Which I
goodness.
Think is the most effed up, ridiculous theory I've heard.
I concur.
And a contemporary critic, one of my mentors, actually, when he reviewed Chinatown, he saw that scene as a very sexual scene. He didn't elaborate, so I don't know if I see
I'm
castration image, perhaps.
I'll take the meta, the whole, you know, you mess with me, this is what happens.
I'll take it for what I see it as, yeah.
But it's also unusual to see a major actor who's going to be wearing either this awful bandage mm-hmm. or have a scar on his nose for the rest of the film, and it's unusual to see a star be willing to take that risk.
I mean, it perfectly works perfectly within the story. Works as basically a character, a piece of character work. It works great in terms of a symbol, but once again, I think on that meta level, you know,
I'm sorry.
And then of course. Actually, if you look what Polanski's doing here, he's basically saying, I'm going to take my actor, I'm going to give him a black eye, I'm going to put this big bandage across his face, I'm going to take away what you think a hero is and have him still be the hero for, as you say, a good chunk of the film.
Because it's the 70s anti-hero, but you're right, he is being forced to have to try to be heroic, even this very compromised position.
Without his looks.
And it's a nice comment for an actor not to be so vain that would go through with this.
Precisely.
But that's why Nicholson's great for this, because he's so confident in what he does, and he can act beyond it.
And also, first of all, Polanski was known for giving specific directions to his actors, were actually acting out the roles for them. And he didn't do it for a lot of the actors here, but he always did it for Nicholson. And Nicholson got really upset about it.
He acted out his roles?
He acted.
I can only imagine that's just sheer manipulation. It's like, I'm going to piss you off.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of passive-aggressive. Now, here we have the scene where he meets up with Evelyn in the restaurant. There's an ironic musical cue here.
And this is the shot that I love of Dunaway.
Yes, I know. We'll get to that in a just briefly. The music in the background is The Way You Look Tonight by Jerome Kern.
Oh, and notice what we're seeing for the first time.
Red.
We're seeing red, not only the windows, not only seats, but the menu.
You're right.
But the menu is red, and she's in black. Look, the menu right there is red.
She has more lipstick than she's had on any other scene.
And now we have red, white, red, and then just some brown.
This is the first color I've seen in the movie.
Well, that's and this is.
Yeah, I think this was the scene where there was an issue with her eyebrows, and Polanski had to like pluck one of her eyebrow hairs, and it caused some tension. But
once again, the true manipulation.
Total manipulation. But this is the real first color that we're seeing.
Yeah,
and there is a heart-stopping close-up of her coming up.
And also look how red her lips are.
Very, very red.
That's what
red.
I mentioned.
And look at the red flower.
The red...
I know you said that. I was thinking, like, picking the seat and that and that.
Yeah. It's absolutely stunning.
And look at the red ceiling. Oh, look at the red lights. No,
backlit smoke. I love that. But look how long these shots are lasting.
That's Sam Osteen, who... Well, I'll say it's Sam Osteen and Polanski.
I'm sure they worked on it. I'm sure they worked on it together.
But if you watch Carnal Knowledge, also made the long, long takes. Yeah. How they basically held. I mean, of course, it helps that you have actually takes that you can last that long, and you have that selection.
I hope you forgive me, gentlemen, if in these long takes I Twitter and I Facebook, because I can't just watch one thing for so long.
Okay, now
I can't.
Oh, attention spans today are terrible.
Okay, now
there's the shot.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful.
This spectacular close up of her. And I think that was taken with a primary lens. I think they had the camera very close to her because I think Polanski wanted to make her feel very uncomfortable, the character.
Oh, yeah.
I would have killed to see it on the big theater screen, that IB Technicolor print you mentioned.
But actually, he's using the same lens going back on Nicholson, now going the other way.
That's a good point.
No, we went to the same. I don't know what lens this is.
I'm not sure because it's a scope, so you have to double whatever a 35-millimeter flat lens would be. Yeah. But when I saw it, I noticed this for the first time when I saw it years later at the County Art Museum when Robert Towne was at that screening, how stunning these close-ups of her were.
No, what I like
it was very sharp.
What I like is that the bandage now is on half his nose as opposed to the whole nose. So it's getting a little better. Also, notice they're both in black, and he's in the black pinstripe, but I love his tie. Once again, now it's black with a little white things on it.
See, because the problem with Panavision, with a widescreen process, is it's hard to, how do you do a close-up there? But here he shows you how to do it.
Why is it hard?
Because you can get too close to the face. You can cut the top of the head off.
Okay.
And that's what a lot of directors today insist on doing.
Also balance and composition. How do you fill the frame?
Precisely. Well,
but also, I mean, actually, they've centered them. They've done it. There's not a lot of negative space. I mean, they're essentially centered. But also, whatever lens you're using, there is no curvature. So it's the equivalent of what, probably like about a 20.
I love the sharp focus, foreground, soft background.
Yeah. Stunning, stunning, stunning.
Yeah, and I like the little hair net. Well, the net thing she has over
her
face.
Her hair is lit beautifully.
It's just
her eyes pop. Look at the light in her eyes.
What's that net called? I don't know what it's called.
White veil.
Which is definitely of the time, but it's perfect for what.
I was expecting it to catch on fire when he lit her cigarette. Actually,
right.
That'd be embarrassing. And of course, now he's questioning her about.
So this has basically been covered from, I think, four camera angles. Two close-ups of them and then two looser. I guess you'd call them a dirty close-up, Serge, the other ones, the longer shots, but very simple.
No, there wouldn't be dirty close-ups. I guess it was two shots.
There was a wider shot.
But all it was, that was all two shots, yes.
I must point something out. Richard Silbert hates this scene because he slipped up. You'll notice in the background there is a very modern building to the left of center.
And
he didn't catch it. They didn't catch it.
CGI will take that out.
I know. Today they could just erase it. There are just a couple of these little gaffes coming up.
It's very prominent. I'm surprised.
Yeah, I mean, because I noticed it as a kid. I said, wait a minute. That's a very modern building.
But then it must have been a decision right on the spot to say, you know what, the hell with it. We're still going to go with it. No one's going to notice.
Because they got the cars going in the background and everything. That's all accurate. But there are a few other little gaffes, background gaffes, that if it takes a few viewings to pick up on. But Silbert kind of cringed at this part.
Mm, you know what? I wouldn't have noticed if you had mentioned it. Then I would have, but it's not so obtrusive.
No, because absolutely.
It's a soft focus back there, thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a good shot.
It is a great shot.
Yeah.
As the DP, I would have hated to have gotten rid of that shot.
Getting to them, I like how their relationship is essentially developing. I mean, it's getting very antagonistic, but obviously it's going to take a different course.
And all the red herrings that are going on.
Right.
Or Gittes of what is the truth. You know, I'm being shown one thing and it's turning out to be something completely different.
Precisely.
And he's getting in deeper and deeper. Apparently the trilogy that was planned for Gittes' character by Town after the two Jakes, it was going to be Gittes versus Gittes about the third finite resource land in Los Angeles circa 1968. But due to the financial failure of the two Jakes, that never came to pass.
It's a shame. It would have been fascinating, depending on who they had to direct it.
Now, Town wrote Two Jakes?
He wrote the two Jakes, and that had a troubled production history. There was a false start back in the 80s with it. And then, because I remember right after Chinatown, and about a year later, they announced, and some of the gossip columnists were announcing Chinatown 2 was in development, but they didn't say anything more about it after that for many years.
Well, I mean, okay, well, now we're going to go ahead and reconstruct. Imagine what history is like. Do you think Polanski would have ever made a sequel?
No.
Okay, well, I think that's probably, and the thing is that Polanski's craft is so tied into what this film is. I mean, and then we saw him. It took Nicholson years to get Two Jakes off the ground, and finally did. And it only did. I mean, the fact is, I mean, he said, "I'm going to direct it." I'm sure he wasn't like thrilled. I want to direct this. But he said, "I want to get this made." Not that he isn't a filmmaker. I mean, he was involved in Easy Rider, but that contributed to basically it not happening. Okay, I like the fact that he's being totally dogged.
And it's all, once again, it's a continuous shot.
And this gives us exposition.
And it's visual.
And it's all visual. And so we get to see, oh, they were together. And then that's
Mulray and Noah Cross.
Yeah.
And this is where we're getting some background.
We're being reminded how important Noah Cross is to the whole thing without actually having him in the room.
Now, I had asked, when Robert Towne was present at the County Art Museum back in 83, I think it was, with Chinatown, the original utilities corruption and scandal in Los Angeles really was taking place in the teens and early 20s, as I recall. And I asked him why he shifted the location or in time to the 30s. He said he felt it was because it would be easier to find locations in Los Angeles, at least at that time, that could recreate the 1930s more than it would be to recreate the mid to late 1910s when a lot of this water issues cropped up. Just thought I would throw that out.
Oh, okay. Well, it works just as well. And, you know, fits in Depression era, that kind of thing.
Because it's not a documentary. It's not based on a true story.
I'm glad it's not a story.
Yeah.
I love the dramatization that's going on.
There were issues, but it's, you know, he's using the issues as a fictional.
Another great touch. They're scraping off Hollis Mulray's name.
No respect. No respect whatsoever.
And we're back to the burnt tones that you're talking about.
Right, and of course he's made to wait and made to wait.
The great wall touch in the background. You don't pick up on that when you first see Chinatown. These little details.
The replacement.
It's right. Basically, everything from Hollis' stuff is being taken away.
It's just taking.
And then you see that in the back there, too.
Precisely.
Nice touches.
And what's interesting here is that the John Hillerman character, there's a sympathetic side to him because you ultimately find out that he isn't the one making all these decisions, and Mulray is trying to get him to work with him to solve what happened.
Mulray?
Mulray is, because eventually he's going to try to recruit this executive to help him get to the bottom of what's happened.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And he's just not going to succeed, because there's no way that the John Hillerman character is going to buck the system.
Killerman is great in this.
Yeah, he's wonderful in it.
But I love what's great about this film also, the way Polanski portrays essentially the bureaucracy of power.
Yes.
And how banal their evil is, actually. Not to borrow ideas from other things.
Right.
But essentially, you know, they're not all curling their mustaches, but they could almost be, in just how off-putting and, you know, saying, we're not going to let you into this whole little plot, and you're going to stay out of this thing as much as you nose your way in. And it's exactly what Hillerman's doing right here.
Because he's a very smooth talker. He's justifying this whole distribution of water and the dumping of water.
Right.
And it all sounds very logical as a great bureaucrat would make it sound.
Right, and the thing is that none of those characters are indicating. They're not saying, oh, but I'm telling you, but I'm really a bad guy. It's like, no. It's like, stay away.
You know what I felt after watching it for the first time was the type of film that makes me, I need to take a shower afterwards to remove the film of corruption from me. I mean, it really just, it's like permeates my pores.
Well, Polanski succeeded, exactly. And Gittes, who is basically he's a private dick who's basically disgusting, and he's the good guy.
Who do I root for in this world?
Exactly. He's a classic anti-hero, and the only way to make the anti-hero,
although he's not as bad as some of them,
sympathetic, is by making everyone else so corrupt around him and make it seem like they're right, but they are just so vile and corrupt that he is the good guy.
Levels of corruption.
He can only be the good guy. And, of course, Noah Cross being the most corrupt in the most base way possible. Now, in terms of that, Max, do you know who wrote, was that Town or was that Polanski who came up with that?
With the negative side of Gittes, the anti-hero?
No. The whole Noah Cross, the whole real dark secret of this whole thing, which, of course, everyone's seen, so they're not going to spoil anything.
Right. But I cannot recall whose idea, whether that was a Polanski touch or not. I've only read the shooting script, which is very close to the released film. There's just a couple of little extra longer scenes and some extra dialogue.
Very daring for 74, man.
Oh, exceedingly. Actually,
when wouldn't it be upsetting and traumatic? I mean, that any time period. But to have that be a pivotal part of the lead actress's persona and character, Faye Dunaway,
yep,
major star in a major film, to have that be the core, yep, that's really something.
And what's amazing to me is that at the 75 Oscars, when they were showing clips from the Best Picture nominees, they showed that clip from Chinatown, which basically gives the story away.
Oh, my God.
But I'm surprised they even showed that on television, a network television.
Wow. And of course, this came the year after The Exorcist, which, of course, challenged audiences in a lot of ways.
Pushed boundaries. It had not been pushed before.
Absolutely.
And got even with the feminists, as some accounts have claimed at The Exorcist. But that's another discussion. We'll discuss The Exorcist some other time.
Oh, my God.
When you look at the directors at this time, William Friedkin and The Exorcist, what they were doing, and what really, it's very impressive.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they
auteurs, basically, in visions that weren't compromised.
But in a way, they had, as you know, they had the freedom during this time to do this stuff.
Well, it was a wonderful thing. First of all, there were two factors. The fact is that most of the studios were freestanding. They weren't all controlled by large corporations. And also, they were coming out of a real terrible economic time when they were losing money and didn't know what to do to get an audience back. And so they were desperate, and they allowed these directors to make different kinds of films. So there was something to be said for economic downturns in Hollywood. But then that's... Who knows? If it had been the minute things got better for Hollywood,
right,
we stopped seeing films like Chinatown.
Right. Well, I mean, bright shining moment. Well, it was basically, I mean, late 60s through about 74, 75, yeah.
Right.
And that's when things basically changed. And in a way, Star Wars, I mean, not to harp on this.
Cultural Chernobyl, please.
I know, but Star Wars in a way was like the tail end of that, and only basically came through because of that culture, in a way that they was able to do that and kind of change the way things were.
I mean, Jaws was considered one of the first stakes in the heart, only because it changed the way films were distributed.
You're right.
Like Chinatown,
you're right,
didn't open all over the country on the same day. It was kind of, you know, parceled out from city to city over a period of time.
I forgot that Jaws was the first big blockbuster.
Mm-hmm. Major event film.
It was.
Yeah,
I mean,
Godfather, of course, was a blockbuster, but Jaws definitely changed the distribution patterns. You know.
Well, I mean, Godfather was a very, very big success, but it didn't. I mean, it platformed at first, right? Or did it open wide?
Yeah, no, it.
Right.
Exactly.
Jaws opened big and stayed big.
Jaws was a wide release.
And Jaws was the first summer event film that caused the summer blockbuster cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because I think Godfather opened at Christmas.
Godfather actually opened in February of 72. Godfather 2 opened at Christmas.
Godfather opened in February?
Can you believe it? It was supposed to open at Christmas of 71, but it wasn't ready.
And they still went with it, and here we are. See, our introduction to the great John Huston is Noah Cross. I love
exactly.
This. It's at Mr. Gitz.
And really, I mean... As a director, I would have been very intimidated to direct John Huston, but I guess Polanski was able to hold his own.
I don't think anyone intimidates
Polanski. You're right.
Am I alone in this, or did anyone see There Will Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis?
Yes, I saw it, yes.
Yes, he's
completely channeling John Huston.
Yes, he's imitating John Huston in Chinatown. Absolutely.
You have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake.
You're absolutely correct.
I started laughing, and There Will Be Blood. I'm like, oh, my God, this is so Huston.
You can't take it seriously. And once again, this is Polanski showing confidence in his staging. The camera's sitting there, wonderful master shot of the two terrific actors.
Oh, yeah.
Would you guys say that this is John Huston's best on-screen role?
Sure.
I'm willing to go with that.
No, I'm sorry. Battlefield Planet of the Apes, Lager.
Sorry, Serge. We'll have to give you that, I guess.
Okay, I'll give you this. This is the most famous film that he's ever acted in.
It's funny, when I had to see this several times before I experienced the poignancy of Huston's performance at the end.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's the end where the great thing is here, he commands. He can definitely deliver and command and manipulate, but at the end, his vulnerability,
absolutely,
and just in the horror of what he's done. But he doesn't care because he's just so warped. And that's the thing. He's pure corruption.
In this lunch scene, I'm surprised. Is Huston eating steak?
No, they're eating fish.
Oh, good. They're both mutually eating fish.
They're both with the heads
from
on.
Water. I thought maybe...
Oh, so there's the water motif again.
Huston would be eating shrimp.
We have water glasses in the foreground.
Absolutely.
I thought I'd throw that in there.
No, good. The water motif, I had not noticed how prevalent it was in the film until seeing it again.
And notice also the power play. He's got the servant standing behind him.
Yes, and what's also interesting here, at one point...
Mr. Getz.
At one point, he asks Nicholson, are you sleeping with my daughter? Now, in real life, Nicholson was sleeping with John Huston's daughter. He was with Angelica Huston. They were living together.
Oh, at the time, that's right.
So Huston Nicholson sort of channeled this tension, this real-life tension into this scene.
Oh, this is awesome. So wait, did this contribute to the whole casting of John Huston in this?
That I can't tell you.
Oh, but it's brilliant.
But it's brilliant. A very interesting parallel.
That is
art imitating life,
brilliant.
Life imitating art. What's up?
And of course, you know, later in Preetzi's Honor, which John Huston directed, and of course, Angelica Huston plays Nicholson's spurned lover, and she gets him in the end because she gets the last shot.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. They are clearly very interesting relationships going on.
There actually was a Time cover story on Nicholson when this film opened, although he wasn't in his Chinatown costume. There was a cover story of him with a big grin, and it said, the star with the killer smile, and it was Time to coincide with Chinatown's release.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know what? I have to say something. Back in film school, we had to, you know, direct scenes from a book of, like, scenes from films. I directed this scene.
You did?
The one we just saw. And with the mariachi band, and then afterwards. And the interesting thing, because I hadn't seen Chinatown before that, and then I did it, and then I watched it, and it's very interesting how when you're interpreting a scene, you watch like where you get things the same as them. And actually, I got like one or two identical moments to Polanski. I'm not saying it's like, but it's interesting how the material itself yields itself to find those same moments, which is very interesting.
It brings it out in a director. That is interesting.
Which was really, really cool. So when I watched, it's like, oh, this is wow. I saw kind of differently, but a little bit the same. Of course, I didn't see the waiter standing there the whole time either.
Good, yeah. And Huston was excellent at that moment when Gittes catches him.
And actually, there is actually, in this scene, there was a little bit, there's a part of it that was cut out that's in I think, in the book, where he talks about shit, horse shit.
Yes,
the whole
time
about horse shit thing, and that was cut out of the film.
It was in the script.
Because I think he's looking down and he's saying, what do you see right here? And this is horseshit or something like that. This whole metaphor before they go into this whole thing.
Yeah.
If you read the script, you'll see it. Yeah.
Yes, it's weird.
Well, that's the thing. You don't miss it, but it's very interesting to read it on the page. But it slowed everything down. It's sort of like saying, okay, now I'm telling you I'm a bad guy as opposed to let's just, you know, live through this.
Now, Jerry Goldsmith, the score that really put him on the map as a young composer was Freud, which was a John Huston film.
Ooh, fascinating.
In 1962.
There's that connection.
Yeah.
And I know he did also the original Planet of the Apes score.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Goldsmith did that. He did Escape. I think he did Conquest.
Just two.
Oh, he didn't do Conquest?
He only did two of the series.
Oh, he did Escape. I didn't know that.
No, he did do Escape. Oh, yes. I can hear it right now. In my head.
Yep, that thumping bass line.
And this scene is quite amusing. Great. With the
once again all earth tones and
very bad acne on the part of this upstart behind the table.
And it's interesting. Well, I mean, going back to 74, this was about this as high. You know, this was it would have been the same kind of tech. You look at it now, nothing would be like this now.
Very much everything.
So now this is real period, super period.
Definitely. A little Hitchcockian moment there.
That's right. Pulling
POV.
Back behind. That's
POV.
Right.
Now, Max, you had mentioned as far as the title, Chinatown, Robert Towne's intentions with it versus Roman Polanski's literal.
Yes. Originally, Chinatown was not supposed to be shown at all in the film.
Which I got to tell you, I have no problem with.
Well, no, but of course, writers love the allegory and the whole thing. It was supposed to be a state of mind. It was supposed to be symbolic of something. But apparently, in the course of several production meetings, Towne felt that people who previously had made very intelligent decisions started to cave and get panicked and decided there had to be a scene set in Chinatown. And that was one of the arguments he had with, I guess, Polanski and also Robert Evans.
And I have a little tidbit along those lines from IMDb of all sources. We'll see how true this is, but it says Robert Towne says he took the title in the famous exchange, "What did you do in Chinatown?" as little as possible, from a Hungarian vice cop who had worked in Chinatown. The cop explained to Towne that the complicated array of dialects and gangs in Los Angeles Chinatown made it impossible for the police to know whether their interventions in Chinatown were helping victims or furthering their exploitation by criminals. As a consequence, the police decided the best course of action was to do as little as possible.
Isn't some of that explained, or I think someone talks Gittes, a little bit.
Well, he says that line a couple of times.
Little as possible, he says that at the end in Chinatown.
Because he first says it in the scene with Evelyn Mulray, the post-coital scene.
Oh, I love this.
this is quite amusing.
That's right.
Unless you're a preservationist such as I, we find it appalling. But and then here we come back to the bright open exteriors.
And now he's in the valley, right?
He's in the valley.
Theoretically. Where did they shoot this, actually?
I don't recall this being filmed outside of California. I've always thought of this film as being shot entirely in California.
Maybe they shot this up in Santa Clarita. It's like I kind of know where it was, and I've forgotten. I think it may have been Santa Clarita. Clearly not the valley, because the valley was built up by now.
All I can tell you is the film started shooting in October of 73. And this was a smaller portable camera that they shot it with.
As my mom would say, "Ooh, look at the nice old cars."
Yes. And Goldsmith's music has backed him.
That's right.
Strumming those piano strings.
Mm-hmm.
That worked well.
That's a great shot.
This is an impressive, because Nicholson is doing his own driving here, and you've got the camera in the back seat, and this is not an easy shot to get.
That's right.
And we don't have any music, which is great.
Oh, we have the music of the sound effects, and look at that horse chasing after him. Wow.
As far as Goldsmith's score, the times that there's action and something physical, it's very dissonant, very atonal. But anytime it's emotional, it's very lush and melodic, and that Chinatown love theme.
Oh, and what is it? Where they get the radiator, so the water's spurting out.
This scene always struck me as a little out of place in the film. It seems like.
Why is that?
Well, with some of this slapsticky stuff here, I don't know. It never quite worked for me, but then you have to have something for the audience to.
It's slapsticky because these guys are not really real bad guys. That's why.
Also, he's really pulling his punches with that crutch. He's not hurting Nicholson. If you look at it, he's pulling his punch before he's making contact with his body.
Oh, that's a good point. I didn't notice that.
It's not slamming down on him like it should.
Yeah. Now, Nicholson's sunglasses, if you notice, are missing. They're missing one of the lenses. Okay. That is an in-joke to Bonnie and Clyde, to Warren Beatty at the end of the film during the lead-in to the massacre, or perhaps during the shootout. He loses one of his lenses in his sunglasses. And Nicholson and Beatty were good friends.
What I like about this is how much Nicholson, how much Gittes stands his ground against these people.
Yeah.
Which was uncharacteristic. I mean, and once again, we're back to handheld.
This film was actually screened at the Environmental Film Festival in Washington, D.C. in 2008.
Oh, wow.
Because it really is a film that deals with environmental issues. This is the valley before it becomes, covered with concrete and urban sprawl or suburban sprawl.
Right, which is what they're starting to do here is they're starting to drive out all the orange groves so they could develop it.
And we'll be hearing more about that later.
Boom.
I guess it was the kick in the groin that I always felt was beneath the film, but anyhow.
Gotta do what you gotta do. Now this, it fades out.
Yeah.
Because he's passed out.
Right.
And it comes up on him again. So we've never missed a beat. It's still Nicholson.
Exactly. It's all through him.
There's not a single scene without Nicholson.
Now you said it was shown at the Environmental.
It was included. This was in 2008. They showed a pretty new print of the film because they don't want to just do current documentaries about the environment. They want to do narrative films that have touched on environmental issues. And they decided to show Chinatown, which I thought was kind of a gutsy move.
It's absolutely, it's wonderfully political.
It's political, and it does deal with the what happens with corruption and the environment.
So that's what I was going to say. Rather than being environmental only, it shows how the environment can suffer due to political corruption.
Well, I mean, exactly. But that's what the trilogy was. I mean, was ostensibly that was right. About the corruption, essentially the corruption of power in L.A. First through water, and then I don't remember Two Jakes enough to say about the corruption in the oil. But clearly, they were trying to continue that whole thing, and then in land, clearly
greed. It's all about
now.
Greed,
notice here they've got the HMIs on them,
mm-hmm.
which actually kind of works.
The HMIs are
they're. On their faces.
There's some light there, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, I guess they're shooting it close to...
Like a sunset.
Close to sunset.
It's not too much. I mean, the temperature of their faces with the temperature of the sky behind them is pretty the same.
But I'm taking it as intentional as the whole thing. It's in other words, it's slightly artificial.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
But I think it's intentional, so it's like... But it's still a practical shot. They're still actually driving.
Right,
which is great, as opposed to you usually do. You know, you'd put a rear projection or something like that.
And once again, it's
I love this.
And this is a great process shot because it's from the side. Usually, process shots are from the front.
Wait a minute. Slow down. This is not a process shot.
That's a process.
And that's exactly what we've always disagreed about, Serge. You say process shot means practical.
No,
process
no.
is a rear screen.
Oh. No. Okay. No. In production, process shot is literally what you do is you take the car and you take it on the road. Okay.
Oh, that's the new term. Okay.
I don't know when we're shooting when I'm working on a film.
Tim knows what I mean.
A process shot is basically I understand what you're saying. The process shot is basically when you take the car on the road and then you have basically the tow vehicle in front and you're driving with it and you're going along.
Oh, okay.
That's where
this has crept up in other films as well, but right. Just to address it, I know that as a practical shot.
Okay.
And process involves a rear screen or an optical.
In front of a motion pictures.
Okay, yeah. But in production, basically, your process shot is with a car. Yeah. When you have the tow car. This is a really weird scene.
It is a strange scene.
It's just odd. And it's odd because I think what's odd about it is how it ends and how it kind of exits itself. And this is the first, like...
Well, it runs the gamut from humor to violence.
But it's also his first big scene with her. I mean, basically he's had, you know, meeting scenes, and here they're actually going out together because he's obviously digging up the little threads of what's going on.
And this is some little comic relief
here. And he's got a red boutonniere. Trouble.
Trouble is afoot. But there's some humor here where he's pretending to commit his father to this rest home, and there's some... little in jokes about his father not accepting people of the Jewish persuasion, of course, Polanski being Jewish.
I hear it is, yeah.
And Faye Dunaway's there, sort of smiling a little bit in this scene.
She's like, what are you doing? And the eyes just went slightly.
So.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Polanski, of course, having survived the Holocaust. So.
Yeah, he had a terrible time of it.
He
was born in Paris in 1933, and the family disastrously relocated to their native Poland in 1940.
Man. Yeah.
Very bad timing. The parents were put in concentration camps. Only the father survived.
Wow.
Polanski lived on the run in wartime Poland.
Yep.
And eventually...
Yeah, he worked his way west. Yeah, I guess he wound up back in France, but obviously got to the States.
Yeah, got to the States after making three films in England.
Yeah.
Repulsion, Cul-de-Sac, and Dance of the Vampires.
What about Knife in the Water?
Knife in the Water was his first feature that he made in Poland. That was the only Polish feature he made. He had made a number of acclaimed short films for the Woods Film School.
And this is great because this is all visual. I mean, you know where he's been kind of going with this, and there's no I'm explaining, but we see visually.
There's a little bit of explanation, but it's done very tastefully and not.
It's wonderfully as opposed to we're going to explain what's going on. Well, he explains a tiny bit, but we discovered as they discovered. That's a great thing.
And you do get some, you know, Gittes comes off more appealing here because he seems to be concerned about the fact that these women are being exploited. The fact that they...
Well, I think he's just really taken aback. And the total level of corruption that these guys are running to do what they're doing. I mean, just the labyrinthine plot these guys have cooked up that he is uncovering is incredible.
The onion is unraveling.
And so many films have tried to capture the spirit of Chinatown over the years.
Look at the fish.
Oh, there's the fish motif again. The Albacore Club.
Ah, there you go.
Which Geddes thought was Applecore?
He thought it was Applecore, and he was chastising one of his assistants for wasting his time with needless information. Of course, it turns out it was a very important piece of information. And so Geddes has been exposed.
Of course, and with the guy with the red boutonniere.
And pretty soon we're going to be switching to handheld photography again as things get very intense in this scene.
I think it's in one or two shots because it's now just still falling around.
Max, you had mentioned to me...
Oh, there's Mobile Hill.
Mm-hmm. Concerning the score, there's one moment that sticks out.
That's coming up. We're not there yet. You'll hear about it.
That's right.
Because I'm loving it so far.
I'm intrigued to know what that moment is.
Now, there's a little bit of a gaffe, another background issue.
You can see the gels on the door.
No. Actually, you can see that it's modern cars in the background.
Oh. Now, what's great is that the way he treats the violence, he treats it real.
That's not true. Any
fakey kind of violence.
No.
And it's all handheld.
Yeah.
Violence is ugly, and I like it when in film it's
absolutely
perceived as ugly in its execution.
And he has every right to do it, and I love this.
Awkward and ugly.
He kicks that gun. He or she kicks the gun. I can't remember what it is. Oh, that's right. He goes to...
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
I remember that gun. And then the music comes in.
That's right. And he's like... And he picks up his head, and he's just going to go.
And then we're going to see Polanski reemerge outside. And if I'm not mistaken, in the background, you may also see the freeway in the distance.
And mm-hmm. I'm not even paying attention.
Right.
But that's great. Exactly. He comes up, and it's like, and we're out of here.
There's a lot of light on them.
Yes.
And this is basically foreshadowing the end.
Oh.
Good point. Very good point.
And we're basically, as John would say, we are close to the 75-minute point.
Structure-wise?
Basically structure-wise, which at 75 minutes, you basically hear or see, or you know how it's going to end. And basically, we just had that. Mm. John strikes again. We need John back from his summer deeds.
I mean, the scene of the woman tending to the man's wounds and that leading to a sexual encounter, it's almost become a cliche in Hollywood films, but I hadn't seen it done that often before this. But this, as I mentioned earlier, John Alonzo, the cinematographer, when he was interviewed in the film Visions of Light, was nervous because Polanski was going to be shifting from these very stationary shots mm-hmm. to handheld once they become more intimate, which you'll see in the next show.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm.
But then when he saw the results, he realized it was the right decision.
So the sex scene is all handheld?
Or the kissing scene that we're going to see is handheld, and then the bedroom scene is not.
Oh, I haven't seen, I guess I just saw this once. They jump, you don't really see them rolling around.
No, there's no sexual.
Okay. No, I think there's some brief nudity.
There's some nudity,
on her part and
his part.
Really?
Yes, you'll see.
Okay.
But here we have the classic composition. That's how you use Panavision. That's how you use it, student filmmakers who are hoping to be directors.
How do you use it? How do you use it, Max?
This is how you use it, composition-wise. I mean,
but usually you have to frame. I hate to tell you now, you have to frame for 4:3 for quote-unquote TV for Save Zone. Well, actually, I don't know. It might be changing to 16 by 9.
I don't think anybody cares.
16 by 9 is
the
standard for monitors.
Yeah. But
for monitors, but when you're shooting, I think you still have to keep in mind that it has to go up to 4:3.
I think most films today are
I don't mind. I don't mind the change, but I'm just telling you.
Anamorphic aspect ratio, even if they're shot digitally, a lot of them are. Now here, let's see.
Well, 16 by 9 is 1/7:8.
So. Right, but what I'm saying is 4:3 is... Mm. On the way out, due to the fact that most everything is at least that 16:9 ratio.
Right, I'm all for the wider screen, absolutely. Though actually, that's actually more of a modern thing because when did that start coming? Because everything was 4:3 until, early 50s, mid-50s?
Or are you talking about the
formats?
Aspect ratios.
Aspect ratio, well, 1953 was when CinemaScope.
Okay, yeah, so before that, everything was 4x3. I mean, if you see anything, Citizen Kane, Casablanca, everything's 4x3.
Going back to the silent era.
So, in a way, this is, you know, this, which was...
235.
I mean, it's great, but it's more of a modern thing.
When Faye Dunaway was on the Actors Studio, I remember her talking about this scene in particular, saying how difficult it was because it was such a confined space and the cameraman was just down her throat.
Right.
And to do this scene, it was just hot. She said it was incredibly hot and very uncomfortable.
But you know what? And she does a great job in this. She really does. Look at this.
Well, I think also Polanski liked the fact that she was a little anxious with the camera being so close.
Once again, I think we have to assume that Polanski's intentional with absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And here's our love theme from Chinatown with that bad sex trumpet line.
And I but I like how her head is buried into his arm, and then they just go to afterwards.
That is a jump cut. Yes. Okay.
Well, it jumps in the scene.
I remember. I'm just having a flashback here to when I first saw it, because my parents and I, we always had to analyze every movie we saw, even when I was a teenager. And
that's great.
I remember there was a discussion about the scene, and my mother felt, you know, it slows the action down. Polanski should have cut the scene, and I don't agree with that. But I do want to point out that Robert Towne didn't write this scene. The dialogue in this scene, perhaps it was done by Polanski. He didn't care for... Robert Towne didn't care for Evelyn saying things like, you must have looked cute in blue or something when he talked about being a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, the way Towne wrote it, after sex, Gittes looked at Mulray and said, I'm sorry, yeah, he looked at Evelyn and said, I hope it was something I said. But anyhow, it was supposed to be a little subtler. And he also imagined Evelyn Mulray as being more of a California girl, maybe blondish hair.
Okay, look at her for a second. I'm sorry.
Yes,
look at her. She looks almost Chinese.
She does.
She looks. I'm sorry. She looks Asian. Just the way either she's lit or just the way the makeup is, but just it's very very subtle with the cheekbones.
It's very true.
I was just like,
whoa. It's the one angle in the film that stands out with her.
Exactly.
That's unusual.
I mean, it she doesn't look otherwise. But him looking at this, like, wow.
Now this was the scene. I'm not sure where there was a touch of an electric piano here, and that's what I didn't care for.
Oh, in this scene?
In this scene. We may have missed it already, but there's a little bit of an electric piano there, and I think that's the only part
that is out of context.
That was way too out of context.
Now, I remember looking at, in film school, we looked at this film, and then there was a point when my film teacher brought this out, but where she does something very, very subtle. You know, everything is great, and then when the scene turns, she does this very subtle thing where she covers herself up, because right now she's just open.
Because this is an awkward angle with her.
Right.
And obviously it's done for a reason. It's a strange, awkward use of nudity, or partial nudity.
Well, that's the thing, yeah.
Town apparently didn't think she should be so upfront about her neuroses, but it makes for an interesting character.
Oh, but I think that the upfrontness about neuroses is just the icing on the truly deeply fucked up situation she's in.
You're right, because the real Evelyn, which makes us wonder if the eventual incest theme did play a part in Town's screenplay.
See, she covers herself right there.
She's suddenly feeling very vulnerable. Yeah, it's a
strange. And this is where she gives him a clue right here, right?
Right, because she knows more, and it's all about her peeling back, because she has to betray her father, who is essentially, you know, has been her lover. Ugh. And but that's the whole thing. I mean, she has to betray this
father, lover, father, lover.
Smack. That's the thing. Look how covered up she is. And here she's...
The minute she talks about her father, she covers herself up.
It's how twisted she is inside, and she can't reveal it because, you know, it's all... Either that or she just wanted to not show her breasts so much.
No.
It could be just that.
With Polanski directing, you do what you do what he tells you.
Well, exactly. That's the thing. But psychologically, just we are so not even close to what's really going on with her.
From what I've read, she has difficult times with sex scene exposing her body scenes. In Network, she had a very hard time with the William Holden scenes.
I would imagine. And
well, yeah, and yeah. And that's totally understandable. But that
I totally understand.
But that can be, but in that sense, that can be used. And I think Polanski is smart enough to be able to use that in the context of the movie. Maybe not other directors. I'm not saying they can or can't, but
and it, her discomfort adds to the tension of the scene.
Absolutely, and it gets used. That's a very modern shot.
In terms of
the way it's lit.
Mm. Hmm.
Now, of course, we can talk about the whole symbolism of, I mean, the two stories. The one is basically the, essentially, the raping of the land by the stealing of the water and the whole thing of the whole incest story of, you know, essentially what Noah Cross does. I mean, that's kind of clear symbolism, but it's
not to me until you mentioned it. But I think that's amazing.
But it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
What's,
and now, of course, what she do? She takes a shower because she has to wash herself clean.
And we hear water.
And we hear water
again. And we hear water. That's the whole thing. So it's,
and you see a little bit of Jack Nicholson here, for those who are interested.
Right.
For those who are interested.
There you go. There's his butt. Well, you saw in Carnal Knowledge, too, so.
That is true.
And he was as good as it gets.
He was a
thin. No.
This I love. This is great. This goes back with the watch. I was like, that is absolutely brilliant.
Using the, and then they cut right to the
exactly, and then you know, and it's all visual. You know that he's following her, and he wants now unearth even more of the story.
Nice little propulsive noir theme going with Jerry Goldsmith, and that little sound in the back he uses. I don't know what it's called. I wish I knew what it was called. That instrument that strums. Room 222.
Is it the soap board?
Yeah, it sounds like that.
He does it well where sometimes they overdid it in the 70s.
He used it a lot.
Everything was overdone in the 70s.
A lot of those cop TV shows went crazy with that, but he controls it. And, of course, the soundtrack here is very eerie and very powerful.
Well, I mean, I think the sound you're talking about is, that's a great shot. Of course,
it's stunning. I'm talking about the scene that's coming up when Giddes begins, when he's
starting to
being the voyeur.
Right.
Nice little crane move.
No, I was going to mention basically a lot of that sound is also the Lalo Schifrin sound.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Who did a lot more TV than Goldsmith did, but definitely they were.
But Schifrin
that's where that sound. That's a different kind of sound, obviously.
Nice, wonderful long shot here.
That's really well lit up.
Yes.
Night shot.
Lit up the garage in the background.
The garage, the side of the house. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the porch.
And this is the sound here is great.
And of course, now we get the inner part of the story.
It's held notes. It's held, and it bends, and you have other strings coming in.
And you hear
in.
Like almost like voices being distorted. Isn't that right, Tim? Mm. Can you hear that?
I don't hear any vocals.
Listen.
No, that's from its. Oh?
Like a howling.
Ooh. Well, this is very mysterious music.
That wasn't the human voice, it was some other instrument, but it sounded. It's just very unsettling.
Okay.
Now, this is, this goes back to, at the beginning when he was voyeur.
It was almost omen territory at that
pre-omen.
And, of course, we go into the window.
As far as the score.
But notice it's all, once again, it's from his point of view. We're from the outside looking in. We're not inside.
Exactly. And he this is a theme.
And the thing is, it also represents him being kept out of the story. Just like us, we don't know the whole story. He doesn't know it, but we're being kept out of what the story is.
Barbara Leeming, one of Polanski's biographers, pointed out the significance of the window in Polanski films and people staring through the window voyeuristically.
Yeah.
It's a sexual image, but we see it in... With Sharon, that's wonderful.
It's in the mirror.
The face
in
the mirror. Yeah, I love this. This shot. It's mostly from this angle. There's a glimpse in the reverse.
That was a pullback. That was not a zoom.
I was going to say
it was pullback.
It almost looked like a zoom, but it was a pullback. Yeah.
And I particularly love the way that her face is lighted.
But also the shadows, kind of almost a Star Trek thing. Almost.
It's a very noir shot.
Almost a Star Trek thing.
Where they lit the eyes. In Star Trek, the series? Come on. Look, you see how the light is just cut across her head? Because it's
going to take me months to recover from that, Serge.
Keep on watching.
He needed a neck brace for that jump in logic.
Come on.
But I love it how it's on her face.
Absolutely.
And he holds this shot, and only towards the end of this shot does he reverse the angle.
And what you get to do is you get to enjoy actors doing their craft
exactly.
because the shot lasts to let you do that.
But what's great about this is it's a two-shot. It's not from the front. Once again, remember he did that in the car. Now he's basically slipped it to the other side looking for the passenger. Well, so basically what he's doing is notice, okay, in the car, remember, because when they were driving, it was from Jake's point of view. And once again, yes. It's Jake's point of view. So Jake is in the foreground, okay? We're looking essentially through Jake's eyes, past Jake to her.
It's her shot.
No, she's
prominent.
She's the object, but he's the subject.
She's the focus. This is great coming.
It's him observing. Oh my God!
Obviously, a foreshadowing.
Oh, the ending.
Oh, we're all.
And that's the same
clues.
Exact tone of the horn that we hear at the end. The pitch has got to be exact, identical. A bit.
Pretty close, yeah. But of course, it lasts much longer.
That was very good, Max.
Oh, I picked up on that when I was a kid.
I didn't even
wow, that really is good.
But it's all been one shot right here.
That's still well. Of course, they're great actors and great craftsmen. Everyone.
And that's what's wonderful, because they don't trust actors are not, directors and editors don't trust actors anymore. They insist on over covering things and over editing a lot of scenes that don't need as much.
But I think there's a lot of politics that go with that, and also basically going back to the whole corporate control. There are more hands in the pot that say
everybody has
we need
their
to this, and now it switches to her.
See exactly
because now, see this is Osteen working.
Didn't overdo it.
Oh, totally not.
I just
carnal knowledge is just like that too.
The first time I saw this, I just knew. I mean, they're doomed. I did not think that they were going to have a happy relationship.
Oh, everyone is doomed.
I mean, Nicholson's
in this
face
film.
Here, which you really get a sense, he's like he's really realizing how.
Oh, he doesn't. He has no idea.
Whatever idea he has is not
exactly. Doomed. But that's the whole thing. He thinks he knows, and he really doesn't know
how deep this thing is running. And then we get to a close-up here.
Exactly. Because the whole her secret's just tearing her apart because she's told no one. No, you know, this is the deep, deep, dark secret.
Look at a reflection in the window on the left.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Look at that.
Kind of the rim lighting?
No, that was her reflection in the I don't know what the window
is. I missed
it,
gentlemen.
It was very good.
Next time you watch it,
water,
you can see
water. Again. Water everywhere, not a drop to drink.
And I like the stitches in his nose. It's getting, you know, slowly getting better.
It's good continuity.
But it still dominates the action.
Wow, look how young he is.
And handsome. I mean.
But he has black drapes.
Oh, what I wanted to mention about this score and that trumpet line and the sound of the trumpet, Robert Evans, who produced Players with Ally McGraw.
Right.
Jerry Goldsmith did the score,
mm-hmm.
and Robert Evans said in the last cut of music before the end titles, it was sort of bittersweet in the film for whatever reason. I never saw the film. Robert Evans wanted that same trumpet sound to recapture the Chinatown magic for Players. So Jerry Goldsmith, under orders, provides a trumpet sound, melancholy, that recalls the trumpet line of Chinatown in the last cue before the end credits of Players.
Interesting piece of information. I didn't know that.
And it did not bring the same magic back for the film Players, I assume.
Well, it's like Martin Scorsese apparently pressured Bernard Herrmann to include those three psycho bars at the end of Taxi Driver, because I always thought that Bernard Herrmann was doing it as a signature, but apparently he was under pressure.
Yeah. Who's that call from?
That was an anonymous phone call from someone saying that Ida Sessions wants to see him.
Ida
Sessions is the real name of the Diane Ladd character who was masquerading as Evelyn Mulray in the first scene of Chinatown.
And she doesn't come to a good end.
Yeah.
A simple shot.
Is Diane Ladd Laura Dern's mother?
Mother,
yes.
She is.
Yes.
And they
appear
together.
Bruce Dern's ex-wife?
Ex-wife. And the two women appeared, mother and daughter appeared in David Lynch's Wild at Heart.
Wow. What is that thing in the? It's hitting in the background, the music.
The percussion?
Yeah.
I don't know what instrument that is exactly, but that's Jerry Goldsmith's very 70s percussion sounds going on.
It's Peter Bogdanovich always complained that music scores date films very easily. So it's a credit to Jerry Goldsmith's score that even with these 70s elements, it really holds up beautifully.
And he was determined not to make it a period sound and to let it sound more modern because the setting and everything was period enough, as I said before. Right. He didn't have to be redundant with period music.
It was very daring because how many times have we seen films that try to appeal to younger audiences? Maybe they're set in the 19th century and they'll put a rock score on it and it just looks ridiculous in future years.
Right.
Well, I mean, I think it's of the time. It's a different director, different vision.
Precisely.
Once again, I think, oh, great piano.
This is a very ominous
piano. Great piano. Notes. Great piano, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, he's going to Ida Sessions. Okay, so who did send Ida Sessions?
I think it's Noah Cross trying to sucker Jake into this to make him do what he wants to do for his ends in this whole conspiracy that he's doing.
Because he wants Hollis out of the way.
Yeah.
Right.
But Gittes turns out to be a problem rather than someone that's going to facilitate his goals instead. And he has to contend with Gittes because he finds out more than he should.
Or was Gittes the perfect patsy? As and we see here.
Dead Ida Sessions.
Yep. Oh, I like the drip of water.
There's that water motif.
Oh, look at the
again.
Ice cream melted on.
Yeah, the details here are just fantastic.
Wow.
And in a moment, he's going to pick up her purse or her wallet, I believe, and go through the wallet. And the details of that are very impressive.
And that's what is so depressing, is that Jake is used by Houston's character, and Houston gets away with everything.
Well, yeah.
We'll definitely get to that. Now, you'll notice if you look carefully, there's a $2 bill in there. And at the time, the $2 bills were discontinued, so that was a really cool retro inclusion.
Now, that's a Social Security card that's modern. They did not look like that back in the 30s.
Very good.
That's the wrong
somebody blundered.
Typeface and color. It's a blue color.
That's
not
a very good point.
That's like the Coca-Cola bottle in American Graffiti. I remember that Lucas apparently got very
mad
at.
Which I've never seen.
I don't say too much of that.
Dude.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, because I'm going to give away so much with the Coca-Cola bottle.
Remember when I saw this at the County Art Museum, a woman sitting in front of me, she cringed when he was reaching for the door. She was afraid to look at the screen. And there's Lou Escobar. And this also is handheld, right, gentlemen?
Yep.
Oh, yes. It's a tight space, too.
There's you have that flare above that guy's head.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as bad as the Bridge of the Enterprise, but...
I guess I can talk quickly about the Technicolor IB process.
Please.
1974 was really the last year, although it continued a little bit into 1975, that Technicolor released dye transfer prints. These were film prints that were similar to silk screening, this idea of rolling color dyes onto release prints of film that gave the very rich, very solid, and stable colors.
Which aged very well.
Which aged beautifully.
They didn't deteriorate.
They didn't deteriorate. They didn't fade. You could see a print of Chinatown if it stored properly, and it would look just as vibrant as it did when it was first shown. Mm. And The Godfather Part II, as I understand it, was the last brand-new release film to be released in dye transfer until they tried reviving the process in the 1990s for a short time.
Hmm. So 74...
74
was the major cutoff.
And I think a reissue of Swiss Family Robinson the following year was the last official use of dye transfer for the States. And
really? The 1960 Disney film?
Yes. And then they Technicolor sold the equipment to China. So the Chinese had the benefits of dye transfer for quite a while.
Wow.
And then Technicolor, around the time of Batman and Robin in the 1990s, tried dye transfer again, but they didn't promote it properly, so nobody... knew or cared.
So the chronology, since Swiss Family Robinson was a re-release, Chinatown was the last current film.
Godfather Part II, but Chinatown was the last official full year of new releases being released.
I thought, what a coincidence, Chinatown, then they sell the technology to China. And Chinatown being pretty much almost the last film in that process.
All the symbolism.
Ooh, it just goes deep, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Now, Eastman Color is the one with all the problems. All the film shot
yes,
Eastman
the
Color.
Eastman,
that,
very, very...
As compared to
as Technicolor.
Because
Technicolor, in general, involved the camera and the printing, not the film stock. So they were always using Eastman Color stock, but it was how you put it in the camera, how you processed it, that led to the old Technicolor. And if it was done in a cheaper way, just processing it without these special dye transfer... Which was Eastman Color. You had these prints that faded very quickly. And Deluxe Color was notorious as well for that.
Because I know a lot of restorations have a lot of problems with anything shot in Eastman Color.
Absolutely. And the stuff faded so quickly, especially in the 60s where it was very badly done.
Oh, yeah.
But Warner Brothers and Paramount and Disney were the main companies that used dye transfer. And here we are back to the location where Gittes originally saw Mulray.
Yeah, so basically he's taken them back through the paces of the case. I like... I like how the guy's out of breath.
Yeah. Remember, the screenplay says that Escobar looks at Gittes with hate at this point, which he does.
Yeah.
I mean, the way these detective stories are structured in a way to really keep us thinking about who's doing what to whom and who's lying and who's not telling the truth. And the hero is always trying to get the real answer out of usually the woman,
and
the femme fatale.
And that's the whole thing. He's such an anti-hero because just like, why? We don't even know why he keeps on going. He's got to, because that's what he does. He tries to find out the truth. He's not going to be played for Patsy. Someone's drawn him in, so he's going to find out the whole thing. Not for any great altruistic, not for any great goal of any sort. It's not to help anyone out and rip the scab off and tell everyone what's going on.
Hmm.
You know,
you don't think he's having a conversion
to
truly wanting to set right or wrong?
I don't think he knows. He lives in a small world. He lives in a small world where he's a private detective investigating infidelity.
The optimist in me would hope for his conversion.
I would hope for his conversion.
I would hope so, too.
It's like, but it's so kind of far away. He thinks he can kind of be on the side of conversion, but it's just so far from what he can.
And here's where we resolve this whole character.
Right. That's right. Once again, we have a character who we can be drawn to.
And this is where the broken English comes in. Salt water, very bad for glass.
Yes.
And, of course, the pun there, glass. It literally is glass that he finds in the pond.
Yeah.
Because originally salt water was found in the lungs of Hollis Mulray.
And they didn't know why, yeah.
And they didn't know why.
The body had to have been moved from where they found it.
Right.
It's a very detailed screenplay.
Very, very detailed.
I mean, this is so thought through.
And in a way, the whole thing that he can't pronounce glass properly, as horrible as it is a stereotype, actually points out what you're supposed to pay attention to.
Oh, I know. It works. It completely works. There is a documentary that unfortunately can't legally be shown because it uses all this copyrighted material in a fair usage form called Los Angeles Plays Itself.
Oh, I've seen that.
We watched it together. And it has to do with how architecture and Los Angeles is used in films. And there was a very interesting section on Chinatown. The director or the documentarian takes issue with the fact that the film's message seems to be there's nothing we can really do to fight corruption at high levels, so why even bother?
Well, but that's,
And he thought it was a far too pessimistic message, but I thought that was very interesting.
Robert Towne wanted Chinatown to represent in his title without the film even going to Chinatown. But it was a metaphor for that.
But by going to Chinatown, I think actually Polanski was right and made it actually even better. It made the point
it
that when you go to Chinatown, you know what you get? Death.
So really, it's in the modern lexicon of just verbiage, when something is something, when you find yourself so overwhelmed by something you can't go up against very easily, you just say, it's Chinatown, basically.
Well, and that was basically
a catchphrase for anything that's corrupt.
But it was also, and of course, emblematic and reflected the time, you know, I mean, we could say the times now, but even the times then, which were really complicated with the Vietnam and what was going on.
And Watergate.
And Watergate and how to resolve the complexities. You wanted things to be simpler, but things were just so big and you could sense that the corruption or the darkness was there. How could you get beyond it? And this just basically said, well, we're going to take this to another time, but show, essentially depict this corruption and darkness in another time.
And use it to point up what's happening in the time that this film was made.
Which is the best way to tell stories.
Was, so it was highlighting the '70s, you know, like you said, Watergate and all the corruption that's happening. It was very much the conspiracy time, very much the losing trust.
Well, this is after, of course, the assassinations in the 60s of two Kennedys and, of course, of Martin Luther King. Now, this is the scene, right?
After Nixon. This
is the scene scene coming up.
We must pay close attention to this.
Which was quite a shocker.
Oh, this is why my parents didn't want me to see the film.
And they specifically cited this as the reason?
They just said, no, you shouldn't. No, this film's not for you. I was like, why? Oh, and then when I finally saw it, I'm like, okay, this is why they thought. Whatever. I guess for a child, this might be a little much.
I don't know. I could handle it. I was disturbed, but I'm
with you, dude. Whatever. Don't worry about it.
Because Polanski actually revisits this futility of getting to the source of corruption in The Ghost Rider, his most recent film.
Oh, really?
In that case, it's Ewan McGregor who's the central figure.
He thinks he's got it, and he doesn't have it. He can't figure it out.
And this is the scene they showed in the Academy Awards.
Right.
On network television.
And what's great is the cognitive dissonance, because he can't possibly comprehend it, and when he finds out, he still can't get it.
I remember that was shocking when you first saw it.
Ooh.
I mean, it's like,
and then what?
You know, I mean, God, that looks real. I hope it.
And he's just, and this is horrible.
Yeah, it's, and he throws her in the against the couch. Oh my God!
And he wants the truth. That's what he wants.
I can only imagine audiences in 1974.
And look at that. Polanski has still not gone back to Nicholson.
No, it's on her.
It's on her.
Yeah. My father, get the picture. You know, my father and I.
And look at the negative space on the left.
Yeah, beautiful. And the suitcase.
And boom, there.
And finally we see his reaction.
Now it's like, yeah, exactly, her hat box, where she could be going. She's trying to leave. She's trying to escape.
Now, we were pretty jaded in the 70s as moviegoers, so we weren't shocked that easily, but...
Yeah, this was a pretty big stunner. Don't know how it comes across to anyone. I mean, when you first saw this, Tim, what did you think? Because you didn't know anything about Chinatown, right?
No, I didn't.
And what did you think?
Whoa. Yeah, no, it caught me.
Yeah.
I was very surprised for a 1974 big studio film with these names. For it to be like that.
And the great thing is it's a whopper, and they just build to it and build to it and build to it. So it really has that impact, and it's...
All I knew was that we were not in the glass tower with Faye Dunaway in her designer gown in the Towering Inferno anymore at that point.
No.
Barbara Leeming, the Polanski biographer I mentioned earlier, said that Chinatown was Polanski's travesty of the detective genre, because that's a type of film that everything is supposed to work out eventually. Things are supposed to fall together beautifully in terms of resolution, and instead he really subverts the entire
genre. He's subverted the whole
thing. But how could it have resolution and work out when Chinatown is Chinatown?
And that's the point.
You can't be true to your... You can't be true to it.
Right. This is the anti-detective. I mean, it subverts. Yeah. It's the anti-hero story. It's the anti-detective story. I mean, it really is an extension of the great plots of basically the trends of the 60s with the anti-hero. I mean, you can look at Clint Eastwood. You can look at later Charlton Heston. I know. I threw Charlton Heston in.
Listen. But say what you want about Charlton Heston. He was in some subversive pictures. He may not have been aware of the fact that they were subversive.
Absolutely.
Touch of Evil.
Exactly. And I mean, you see now everything's changed for him. And that's the thing, is Nicholson was perfect for this, to be, you know, to be the anti-hero, even in roles in the early 70s. He was, I mean, if it were Five Easy Pieces, I mean, the scene in the diner was great.
It's funny because when I first saw Jerry Goldsmith's music is a little softer and more gentle.
Well, because, and look, and she's in white. She's the innocent one. I mean, because she doesn't know, right? That's right, she doesn't know.
No, she doesn't.
She has no idea what
because
the truth
Houston
is.
Introduces himself as her grandfather.
That's right.
At the end.
Although she must have not heard the screaming going on upstairs. That wasn't quite...
Nice push-in on... Yes. There are very few push-ins, very few dolly moves in this thing.
Yeah, that would have been the scene if the daughter had been standing on the stairs when Faye Dunaway was getting slapped around. That would have been a whole different scene.
Yes.
But you could only do one thing at a time, and that's the best thing to do. And that's the thing, is that she still doesn't know, and she's in white, she's innocent. Wow, his world has completely changed.
When I saw Chinatown... Oh, it must have been around, it was 20 years, but not 1990, in a theater. I had seen it already a number of times, but Nicholson's performance almost seemed to be so low-key for me because he had become by that time almost a parody of himself. He had been doing so much over-the-top acting.
Right.
And to see him here very contained, very controlled, it just took me by surprise because I hadn't been used to seeing him in that way for so long.
And in a way, is this, I hate saying this, but is this one of his best roles?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's the best performance. It's my favorite performance of his.
Hmm.
More so than Cuckoo's Nest, because I think by the time he made Cuckoo's Nest the following year,
that's right,
I think he was already aware of how good he was, and it was the...
Flourishes?
Yes. You liked what I did in the last scene? Well, wait till you see what I do in the next scene.
If anything, this is the best written role he's ever had.
Oh, without question.
Right.
And critics have said this is the best written, best film that Jerry Goldsmith ever scored.
Oh, I think that's indisputable.
I mean, Patton is up there as well for Goldsmith, but critics have said that this is the finest film that Goldsmith had the chance to score.
This is the one we remember him for.
Oh, yeah.
The best written film.
And it's definitely one of the top screenplays of the, or at least in its finished form anyway, that one of the top screenplays of the 70s, without question. Because the shooting script... I mentioned earlier is very close to the finished film, and it reads very well. But if you actually read the shooting script to The Godfather Part II, it's a disaster.
Hmm. And was that in editing, Nathan?
That was in editing, or they were changing it as they went along. Okay. But this is much more controlled.
I can't imagine seeing this movie as a kid.
I know.
that's the thing.
I would have been lost. I would have checked out. I would have.
Well, because a lot of the concerns are it's a very adult, very, very adult film.
And the older you get and the more you have Chinatowns in your own life, you can understand this film better.
You're going to see a very modern-looking man walking in the background, which today we could digitally erase him if we... He hasn't made his appearance yet. He'll be on the left, but... but I guess for me, I had already been seeing so many films from the 70s that...
Oh, there he is in the back.
Yes, that were... notice it more in a cinema. But I had been prepared for Chinatown because I'd already seen The Godfather, I had seen Cabaret. And this is the
callback,
yes.
Of course. This is he socked her in the eye, that's
right.
Yeah,
he got even. And now we're back to handheld.
That's right, Curly. It cuts back, and it's horrible, but... Hey, this is the guy.
That's the kind of guy he is.
Burt Young is really good in this role.
Yeah, he was under control, too.
Well, because when I, you know, I had no idea, and of course I'd seen Rocky by the time I saw this. I'm like, wait a minute, it's Burt Young.
That's the jerkiest handheld I've seen in the film so far.
Yeah, this is the one that I remember I was least impressed with the camera work.
But again, I think it's completely intentional. Absolutely.
I can see being early
70s. And now we're on a dolly. We're on a dolly there.
Being early 70s, I can see how jarring it was to have handheld up against such fluid camera work in the same film.
It was either you did one or the other.
But that's why I think it was intentional.
Just as in The Godfather, no one was prepared for how much shadows Gordon Willis was using. The studio was appalled that they weren't able to see their big-name actors because they were in shadows.
Exactly.
There was a standard in what was acceptable and how films were shot and how the look was, and, you know.
Unless you used shadows if it was a really low budget, which was the whole basis for the film noir.
Right.
In addition to the German expressionist influence, but a lot of it came out of World War II cutbacks at the studios.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
Keep the lights down and keep the sets are cheap looking, so keep the lights low so audiences won't pick up on the fact that they're cheap. And that's how this style emerged.
And it was just very effective because it was very expressive.
It was exactly.
You just forget, though, when you see something out of context, you're so used to seeing things a certain way now. Mm-hmm. But in 1974, what were the forerunner of what we take for granted now in stylistic choices?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
I like how his shirt's basically untucking in the back.
They didn't miss a touch. Yeah. And so these were pretty much all practical locations. Some of the interiors, perhaps in Giddes' office, were done on sound stages, but whenever possible, they used, except for those handful of backlot shots of the old Paramount backlot.
Now one thing,
the film's better for it.
The film's better for it, absolutely.
Right? Now, going back structure-wise, yes. I mean, this is where the payoff came from the beginning, from having Curly there at the beginning and then having him be used by Giddes, have his favorite, collect his favorite, and allow us to move the plot forward.
Precisely. So he was definitely there for a reason.
Yeah. Nothing wasted.
See how much of his face is in shadow?
And also we hear John Huston. Yeah.
Yes, and we have some great shots coming up. This shot is amazing. Okay, we got the car coming up.
Well, look
now the puff of smoke. We hear the door slam. I think John Huston enters a few seconds too early. I would have told him to wait a bit, but it's really impressive how this whole thing is done all in one shot. It's really quite a long take. It's one of the longest takes in the film.
Mr. Gitz. Man, he totally disrespects him.
And look at the light on Huston's face. He hit his mark.
That's great.
He certainly did. And then
he could direct, he could act. He could
write. Nicholson's in shadows.
Because once again, we're looking over Nicholson's shoulder over to the, you know, essentially the object. Well,
yeah. It's his scene.
Exactly.
We really are focusing.
I mean, you might as well just have done a point of view, but we need to see Giddes in the foreground.
So many directors want to do their big, long camera take shots that are very show-offy, but this is an example of how you do it in a way that really you're not even aware of it.
Well, he went from an over-the-shoulder, basically moved in and went to a two-shot.
But it's not. But then they're going to be moving to the right near with the pond in the background.
In the same shot?
In the same shot.
Sweet.
And then it continues for quite some time, at least until...
But I like him. He's basically confronting him.
He's confronting him and questioning his greed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's basically questioning and confronting the corruption. Yeah. Because he thinks, and actually the interesting thing is here, he's finally trying to face it head on. And he's going to find he can't win. Go ahead.
The time of day.
I mean,
this master shot.
Magic hour.
To get it at this time, they had one
chance.
Little window to get it, and they got it.
That's exciting.
And this was not CGI.
Well, they basically probably had, 15, 20 minutes, maybe half an hour. Mr. Gitz.
He's talking about his whole plan to develop the valley.
Exactly.
Or to incorporate the valley into the... Los Angeles County.
And what I really, and that's very important politically. And of course, what I love is the size of Houston compared to Nicholson. Look how small. Nicholson is puny compared to the bigness. And of course, Houston is.
And Nicholson is a short guy.
I am the power. And Nicholson is just like.
And you really get a sense of it here.
Yeah.
The documentary Los Angeles Plays Itself stated that the real water issues in Los Angeles were not under the table so much. They were quite open. You could read about in the newspaper what they were doing to try to grab water rights and things. And that it's here, of course, it's a little more clandestine and more sinister.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And this is where he starts getting more.
And now it's all, this is all the same take. Now I'm the camera is pulling out and we're going to see, I think it's Mulvihill on the left with, you'll notice, if you look, there's a bandage on his head. Smarting from getting beaten up at the nursing home.
That's right.
And that's all one take. And personally, I'm very impressed. And he gives him the glasses, which are Noah Cross's glasses. And here we are in Chinatown.
Go, Jerry.
I'm not sure which Chinatown this was filmed at. I love, Tim, could you comment on the music here? There's a long period of silence before it kicks in again.
Yeah.
And what does, I don't know what I you just, mean.
No,
listen.
Yeah.
It's going to happen any second now.
What's that?
And then it kicks in again.
So it's still the same piece of music, but with a huge pause.
It only comes in. The pause comes in because we see the white car. That's when we saw the white car in basically off the driver's window. That's how he cued it. Polanski did. He did it intentionally.
That's why,
because it was said, you can go, now you have to look, and basically had that white car lit right there.
Right, but what I'm saying is it's not two different cues. It's one cue.
It was one
cue. Huge, lengthy pause before it kicks in again.
Right, but it was
time
very,
to the
it
screen.
It was seemingly awkward, long pause, and then of course the cops are there.
This scene, I don't know if I've mentioned it. Polanski apparently wrote this scene in Chinatown the night before they filmed it, or the day before they filmed it,
because essentially Town wanted to have a different ending.
He wanted a more upbeat ending where Giddes and Evelyn run off together,
and this is where he lays everything out.
To
Escobar.
To Escobar.
And Escobar doesn't want to listen to it because he's part of now the corruption.
That's right. He doesn't want to hear. And he's about to be locked up when suddenly all hell breaks loose.
That's right.
God, I remember this ending was so disturbing when I first saw it.
Yeah. And we have a camera shadow on Houston.
Yeah, the camera work in this shot, this particular shot, or the one after it, when she pulls the gun, could be better.
But it's an ugly scene. Well, I mean, for me, it all makes sense.
Because, because if you're looking at it, it's lit differently than most anything. We have garish lights in the background.
It's awkward and ugly.
Exactly.
Appropriately
and
so.
Look at the shadows. Oh, this is so...
Out of focus?
Yeah, the out of focus
It's
gun.
Awkward and ugly. I guess it works. It works.
That's good.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
He owns the place.
And? Nice.
Yeah, I remember.
He's just like, I'm grabbing my arm.
Now, many have questioned the accuracy of a gun from this distance getting Faye Dunaway.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
In that light.
You know, it's certainly...
Dramatic license.
Yeah.
And there's the sound of that horn.
Yeah.
Yeah, that works beautifully. After all this film is given, I'm not going to pick over the logistics of the accuracy of that gun at this point.
Oh, I totally agree.
They've got me in the palm of their hand, so...
I totally agree. And this is the scene where
scream.
I'm talking about. The scream is unforgettable. But it's so macabre how she can't bring herself to look away from Evelyn's
And, of course, Evelyn got condition. It right in the eye.
Yeah. And then you really get a sense as the pathetic nature of Noah Cross once he realizes what's happened.
That's a great reaction on John Huston, too.
Yeah. No, that's exactly. No, you really feel it.
this is gritty stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I just don't know.
It's kind of a more desaturated
color. How audiences would have taken
it. Did you catch that? The camera bumped.
It was a jump.
No, it wasn't a jump. The camera actually bumped into someone.
Ugly, awkward. It all works.
That's fine. Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
They cut within the shot there, which was unusual.
I can't imagine any DP saying, we need to make this scene beautiful. I need to lit this, light this just gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah. And I.
But I like how it's just like, it just, you know, essentially just take him home, just get him away from
here. Get him out of here. And I have to point out that Sylvester Stallone did not approve of the ending of this movie. He said that this movie would have been a big, much more successful if Evelyn Mulray had lived. He just, this is when Rocky came out.
What?
Aren't we glad that Sly was not involved in making this film?
There's our line.
One of the most famous closing lines. We don't hear good
closing
lines.
And who is that character that said it?
That's his other associate.
Do we know who the actor is?
Oh, I'm afraid I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, he was in the scenes.
He's in the sequel as well.
Oh, he's in the sequel?
He's in the sequel.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, they were surprised he was still alive, and they were delighted to find that he was.
Was Bruce Glover in the sequel?
I don't think Bruce Glover was in the sequel. I don't think so.
Did we go from handheld to a crane shot?
This is what a crane shot.
But, I mean, they put the camera on a crane, obviously.
Yeah, it had the crane, and basically they backed up on it, and the camera slowly
it,
gets
and then it goes up.
Goes
good
up.
Point.
It's kind of reverse of the Bound for Glory Hal Ashby shot.
And as the credits come up, you'll notice Penthouse appears in the credits. And that's because actually Bob Guccione funded the picture. It was funded by Penthouse.
I never knew that.
And Macbeth, which Polanski made two films before this, was funded by Hugh Hefner of Playboy. And I'm convinced if Polanski had remained in the United States, Larry Flint would have funded his next film.
Yes.
But here we have a quintessential...
Oh, Noble Willingham.
...studio film from the 70s.
Howard was the irate farmer.
Oh, is that related to Ronnie, correct?
That's Ron
Ronnie's
Howard's father.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, it's just a...
Yeah.
It's a shame, as Roger Ebert once pointed out, it's a shame that Roman Polanski could not have better control of his personal life as he did over his filmmaking. This was his last Hollywood film to be filmed in the United States. The film he immediately made after Chinatown was in France. It was The Tenant, which he made for Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after that film came out, the scandal involving the underage girl occurred. And there were no more productions that at least originated in the United States.
Yeah, and they basically did everything out of Europe, out of France.
Exactly.
So, because I think the next big film, at least that I remember that he did, was Frantic, I guess in the early 80s. I mean, there may have been others.
Actually, the first film after he had to, we have Penthouse, a Penthouse presentation.
Yeah.
The first film he made after the scandal of 77 was Tess, and that was a success.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
With Nastassja
Kinski.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here we have the 70s Paramount logo. The original one they used was from the 1930s. And
yeah. So. Anyway, and that, folks, has been Chinatown. Wow. That's some flick. So, So what'd you think?
I enjoyed it the second time much better. I picked up so much more, and I was able to appreciate so much more because I wasn't just so caught up in being disturbed. The first time I watched it, I react emotionally to films. That's just the way I do. I'm not coming from an analytical, intellectual standpoint to process information. I have to work myself up to see certain movies, whether it's Schindler's List or something unsettling. And Chinatown pushed my unsettling buttons. So the first time I was just emotionally disturbed watching it, reacting to it. But this time I was able to appreciate more of the craftsmanship.
And I was able to appreciate all the symbolism that is running through the film based on your observations of the water motif and all these things that I hadn't thought of before.
Well, these are all, I don't want to say tricks. I mean, they're all subtle parts of the craft that essentially Polanski was able to use with his collaborators, essentially, you know, DP, but mostly production design and, I guess, costume to essentially make the tapestry of, obviously, to support everything else. I mean, that he does also working with the actors and camera and how he works with the camera. But all these things definitely contribute to how you experience a film directorially. So, I've just experienced, for me, I've seen Chinatown so many times. I don't remember the first time exactly how I felt. I just know that I know I've gone through different evolutions of it being, okay, let me try and keep track of what the plot is and how it plays in. But I just really just watching it this time, I just now is picking up more a lot of the sense of the, once again, the fighting against the corruption that we were talking about of the implacable power and how basically Jake is the anti-hero, but I mean, he's kind of unlikable, but we wind up liking him because everything else is such shit. I mean, you know, it's just so awful in terms of it's how awfully monolithic and powerful it is. It's nothing you can do. And basically it is, in a way, we all live in Chinatown. You know, we can't do anything about it. It is that whole situation. So
I was really struck in how masterfully it was directed to juggle so many different components to push the narrative along, to keep track of the characters, to know their motivations, to be so clear and yet so muddled in trying to figure out the mystery, mm-hmm. but it leads you to such clarity through its the sum of its parts mm-hmm. coming together and seeing it again for the second time. It's beautifully constructed and put together.
I mean that's Polanski's craft. He's a great storyteller. And he's able to bring, and he's just really a really good filmmaker. It has to do with the clarity. He understands, once again, the clarity of where the characters are, and also, I don't know, I want to call them tricks again, but how to pull out those special things that can help bring to life these different things. And also just somehow how he tells a story like other great directors touches us on some visceral, unconscious level that makes us experience it, whether it, you know, we could look at directors like Hitchcock or Scorsese or David Lynch or even Spielberg. I mean, the earlier stuff that do that.
And also, I thought what worked about the film is here you had an American screenplay, a quintessentially American screenplay written by an American writer who understood, you know, the corruption and the municipal politics and all that. And you had a European director. And they working together, and Polanski was able to bring something to the material that an American director couldn't. And Robert Towne's, I think, source material was able to bring something to Polanski's film that perhaps a European screenwriter couldn't.
And I think sometimes that objectivity helps. I mean, I think one of the better directors today is Michael Winterbottom.
Very interesting.
Who's basically able to take that kind of material. I'm trying to think of another director, some British directors able to come here and look at what we have and basically take that objectivity and be able to tell these great American stories in a way, and they're not even American.
And a lot of the great film noir directors were European. We have, you know, Fritz Lang and Robert Siodmak and a number of others who, Otto Preminger, who were able to really capture a certain aspect of American society very powerfully. So,
or even Michael Curtiz, who, of course, did Casablanca.
There you go.
And he was what, Hungarian?
He was Hungarian.
Exactly. But, I mean, you think of Casablanca, that's an American film.
Very, exactly. Yeah.
A great American film noir, Out of the Past, Robert Mitchum.
There you go, Jacques Tournier.
Another example.
That's right.
Excellent example.
And, I don't think it was an American film. It was Jules Dassin. But Rafifi or...
Well, he was American, but he worked basically in France.
You're right,
he worked the
reverse.
Other way around.
He
exactly.
worked in France and made a terrific French thriller.
Yeah. So, just kind of lastly, how do you think this kind of worked in terms of reinventing, I guess, or trying to recapture the noir feeling, which I know other films tried to do after this, not as successfully?
The first attempt... to my understanding of a retro noir, of a neo noir that was using as its basis the black and white film noir, I think was Clute by Alan Pakula. He said in interviews that he wanted to make a film noir in color. So that was one of the first examples of that.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
Right. I don't believe he succeeded in the way that Chinatown did. Mm-hmm. I certainly think Chinatown succeeded the best of them all because it didn't overdo it. It didn't. It's hard to put into words, but it didn't. It didn't do it to the point where it was becoming so obvious, as some of the other attempts. I'm trying to think. For me, a less favorable comparison is L.A. Confidential, which I know has its followers, of which I am not one, unfortunately.
And actually, I'm kind of in your camp. I can appreciate it, but it didn't do what, you know, like really do what it did for other people. At least that's just my reaction. Also.
Right. I mean, it's a hard anyway. It's a hard genre to emulate. But
yeah. I think Chinatown is a wonderful homage to the film noir genre, and yet it's highly, highly original.
Yes.
In actually, its own vision.
Actually, I just thought of actually another great homage, but it's not a period homage, because I think kind of my question is a noir homage, which I know, of course, we've had Farewell, My Lovely, and a whole bunch of other films that tried to do that, but actually one that's great is Body Heat, which was an homage to the genre, but was set in modern times, essentially modern times, early 80s. Oh, mm-hmm. Ooh, you're missing your lips, Max.
I'll give Farewell, My Lovely some credit, but Body Heat, I have to part from. I just felt that was so self-conscious and pretentious in its attempts to capture this genre. And it just, to me, it overdid it to the point where Chinatown was very subtle and Body Heat, I thought, was.
Okay. So when you said Chinatown didn't call attention to itself, and what you said earlier, you're using Body Heat as a film to make it be an example of what does cause attention to itself and being an homage, and yet getting in the way of its own story because it's doing it too much.
That's how I felt.
Well, yes. I'll buy that, but I have to say I didn't feel that. I think the self-consciousness actually worked in its favor because it said, this is where we're going and I'm leading you through it and we're having fun with it. I mean, that was the way I perceived it. And I watched it recently.
It was more of a lark than Chinatown serious business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all Body Heat was, I mean, it's femme fatale. I'm going to get this guy to murder my husband and get away with it.
Well, and it was Double Indemnity.
It was Double Indemnity. Right. With not as a dire consequence as Double Indemnity or the repercussions. I mean, this was about, you know, the most, I mean, it, once again, you have the parallel stories and one being very symbolic, but I mean, just with the whole just the ugliness of the corruption. I mean, this was all about corruption here, and it used the genre wonderfully to revisit the story. So, okay, and Body was more an exercise in style in visiting a different kind of story of the femme fatale. This is not about the femme fatale, even though one could say Faye Dunaway was supposed to be that character.
Woman of intrigue.
She was a woman of intrigue, and it's about it. She was not a femme fatale. She did not cause anything. She was about as much a victim of anything here. She did nothing malicious. All she was doing was trying to protect her daughter from all this. So
no, here, here.
Yeah.
Without question.
So
Forget it, Serge. It's Chinatown.
And on that note, we're going to wrap it up. I want to thank, once again, our guest from New York,
Max Alvarez,
noted film historian and film lecturer. And by the way, you can go to Max's website at
www.maxjalvarez.com.
And I want to thank, to my left,
Tim McMillan.
And yeah, sure, I'll thank myself. What the heck? Hey, thanks, Serge. Okay.
Thank you, Serge.
Thanks for coming by, Max. I'm really glad you did.
A pleasure, gentlemen.
It was nice to hear your thoughts, Max.
And it was great to hear yours, gentlemen.
You're going to have to come here more often to L.A. from New York.
Got to do it.
Okay. Thanks a lot. See you next time. Bye.